You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dave Webb. Dave Webb is a member, along with me, of the World Beyond War Coordinating Committee. He is chair of the UK Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, as well as vice president of the International Peace Bureau. And Dave Webb is convener of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, where he works with our friend Bruce Gagnon. See spaceforpeace.org, space4peace.org. Dave Webb is an emeritus professor of peace and conflict studies at Leeds Beckett University. Webb has been involved in the campaign to scrap the UK Trident nuclear weapons system and has also focused on campaigning to close two U.S. bases in Yorkshire, where he lives, Filingdales, a missile defense radar base, and Menwith Hill, the huge NSA spy base, where I helped declare independence from the United States a couple of 4th of Julys ago. Dave Webb, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to speak to you on these things.
Well, I'm most particularly wanted to hear from you regarding the upcoming conference that you and the Global Network are planning for April 7th to 9th in Huntsville, Alabama. Can you tell us what this is?
Yeah, sure. Every year, the Global Network organizes a conference to kind of mobilize membership and encourage people to participate in the various kind of campaigns that are going on around the world, really. This year, it's the 25th anniversary, or next year, I should say, 2017, it's the 25th anniversary of the Global Network. And so we're holding the conference in America. We have been last year, well, in 2016, just a few months ago, we were in India with colleagues there talking about the issues of space, weaponization, and militarization. And so we kind of tend to alternate between going somewhere in the world outside of the United States, but then coming back to the United States every couple of years or so, because we see the United States as being the main perpetrator of the militarization of space, really. So this year, or next year, I keep getting the years mixed up, but next year, 2017, will be in Huntsville, Alabama, which is the home of the Redstone Arsenal and the U.S. Space Command's Directorate for Missile Defense. So there's a lot of things going on in Huntsville, which would be of interest to a lot of people. One of the things we try to do is encourage local people to participate in our conference and also in some kind of demonstration or action against the local kind of base or facility which is involved in the militarization of space. So there's plenty of things in Huntsville to keep us busy, I think.
Yeah, I remember attending one of these conferences years back in Omaha, Nebraska, and protesting at a key U.S. military facility there, if I'm not mistaken. Omaha and Huntsville both seem kind of obscure. Can you explain to people why Huntsville is central to the militarization of space?
Yeah, well, as I say, it's the home of the Redstone Arsenal, where there's lots of testing and so on going on there for various aspects of space technology, military space technology. It's also the manufacturing site for the PAC-3 Patriot missile systems and the SM-3 missile defense systems. Those are the missiles which are based on ships, mainly on ships, but also on ashore systems now as well, SM-3. There's just a whole load of stuff going on there, which is to do with manufacturing and testing and development of new systems. It was also the place where, after the Second World War, the German rocket scientists were brought by the United States, you know, illegally, actually. They were smuggled out of Germany. The people that were involved in developing the V-2 rockets, the V-1 and the V-2 rocket systems in the Second World War, they were smuggled out of Germany to help build similar kind of systems, really, in the United States. That was under an operation called Operation Paperclip. And right. That included Werner von Braun and many of his colleagues. So they were taken to the United States to develop systems there. Many of them turned out, of course, to be for the military.
Yeah.
So it's got a history of military operations in space and development of systems in space.
You know, now you can go on YouTube and watch cheerful little videos of Werner von Braun with, you know, Walt Disney videos, but probably most people in the United States don't know that these were people who used slave labor to build rockets in caves in Germany to bomb England and so forth, and then came to the United States by the hundreds and set up almost a colony, would you say, of former Nazis in Huntsville, Alabama, to work on rockets that the United States would use to blow up people in other countries. Do people in Huntsville know this history and think well or poorly of it?
Well, I think some do, but not everybody does. As you say, we tend to hear about the things that the authorities would like us to know about. They may probably not be too kind of willing to get people to know about the kind of things they did in an underhand way, and which don't look too good from a PR point of view. So kind of stealing Nazis and getting them to build up your space systems is probably not something they want advertised too much. But there will be some people in Huntsville, some very knowledgeable people in Huntsville. There's always, wherever we find these places around the world, as you know, that are operating for the military or for the, not really for the benefit of people, there are always a group of people who are protesting about them, who recognize them for what they are and try to do something about it. And there is a group in Huntsville who we'll be meeting up with and who will be hosting us and helping us to find venues and things like that. So, yeah, there's always a group, but generally speaking, these kind of activities are glossed over by the authorities, who don't really want you to know the real history of these things.
Yeah, and when we talk about the militarization of space, are we talking primarily about the use of satellites by the military, or in what sense are we talking about space weapons?
Well, this is a really good question, and it's one that really exercising a lot of people at the moment, I think. At the moment, we are talking mainly about satellite systems, but those satellite systems are particularly integral to all of the military operations around the world that the U.S. in particular is engaged in, but other states too are also becoming very much reliant on their military systems are on space technology, so Russia, China, parts of European Union, and other growing states who have an interest in space technology, because space can be used for not only for communication systems that we're all aware of, and for GPS, which is very familiar, but those things are used to a large extent in weapons technologies as well. They're used to guide drones, you know, to drive drones over long distances to their targets, and all kinds of other activities that are going on around the world. So kind of, I see this thing, this whole kind of space militarization as like a network of satellites, ground-based stations, and other things which are all linked together through these kind of technologies and kind of envelop the world in a militaristic system, which is actually really quite scary when you see the whole scale of it. And at the moment, although we could say there are no weapons as such in space, in that there's no guns or missile launchers or whatever in space that can fire actually things down onto the Earth, there are components of those types of weapon systems that are in space and which are key to the firing of missiles on the Earth or the firing of some kind of technology system that will destroy people and things on the Earth below. So if you can think of some weapon systems as being distributed, you know, not just one, not like a gun, but only where the trigger, the sight, and other components of the gun are separately situated in different places, and some of them, like the sight, would be situated in space.
Yeah.
But things may be getting worse because it seems that your upcoming president, your president-elect, Donald Trump, is quite keen to open up the possibility of actually stationing weapons themselves in space. Just recently, there was some controversy about the wording of, I think it was Congress, who want to scrap one word from the law which opens the door to a space arms race. They wanted to take the word limited away from describing how the U.S. would defend itself against a missile attack. So at the moment, the idea is to defend against a limited missile attack. So a missile defense system against a limited attack. This
right.
would mean a much smaller kind of idea of something that, like a rogue state or somebody, a terrorist or something, who get hold of a missile and fire it off to the United States. So a smallish kind of scale missile defense system against that. But if you take away the word limited, then you're thinking perhaps of a full-scale attack on the United States. And that means you're destabilizing the kind of the system that's developed over the years for mutually assured destruction, which means that neither side who build up weapons systems can really afford to start a nuclear war because of the retaliation of the other side. If you remove the possibility of that retaliation by having an unlimited, a very large-scale missile defense system, then that destabilizes the whole thing and makes nuclear war much more likely. So things are getting quite dangerous from these developments in that have happened and are possibly going to happen in the next few years.
We are speaking with Dave Webb, who, among many other things, is convener of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Check out the website at space4peace.org, the numeral 4, space4peace.org. Dave, there's been debate and proposals from major nations outside of the United States to put a treaty together and ban weapons in space before they are really there. What is the status of that, and which country, need I ask, is blocking?
Yeah, that's I think people can guess the answer to that. I think almost every year for a large number of years now, in fact, Russia and China have put forward proposals to try to prevent an arms race in outer space, the so-called PAROS, prevention of an arms race in outer space. And every year the U.S., United States, with maybe one or two following kind of states or groups, voted down. And that's because they say, the United States says there's no need for it. There's no need for this kind of treaty or this kind of consideration at the moment. But, of course, Russia and China and other states would not propose that if they thought there was no need for it.
Right.
It seems very much likely. Well, it seems that there is really a need for it. The United States, up until now, I think, has just considered itself to be too technologically superior to other countries to have to worry about such a thing. And that's the problem. They want to maintain that technological superiority and deny the use of space to other states. So it doesn't really affect them. It's not a threat to the U.S.
But if the U.S. imagines it can launch a nuclear war on some other part of the globe and survive it by fending off all retaliatory attacks and all blowback and somehow avoiding the nuclear winter that results and so forth, I mean, they're endangering, the United States is endangering us in the United States as well as the rest of the world, is it not? I mean, this is not just a danger to Russia or a danger to China, but it's a delusional threat to us all, isn't it?
Absolutely. Of course, you're absolutely right. I mean, you mentioned the key thing there, which is the after effects of a nuclear war, which would be a nuclear winter that would cause the whole world to be completely devastated for a number of years and affect Americans as well as anyone else. So it's, I think part of it is probably not so much wanting to do it as wanting to be able to threaten to do it. So it's the threat of a nuclear war. It's like a bullying process as well as the actual ability to be able to do it. Mm. But there are some delusional people, I think, in places of power. That's one of the real big problems that we have. And some people will be conned by some of the rogue kind of corporations who have loads of money, that brings in loads of money for them, you know, to develop some of these technologies. They're worth thousands, billions of dollars in terms of contracts. And so they want to keep developing these systems more and more. And some of the politicians can be taken in, I think, by some of the technological promises that are given or made by some of these corporations. So it seems extremely unlikely from the point of view of physics alone that you will be able to produce a missile defense system that would protect you against an all-out nuclear attack. It seems extremely unlikely that you'll be able to do that now or even for many years into the future anyway.
Isn't it increasingly unlikely as well that we'll have additional years and decades of the incredible luck of surviving any accidents or misunderstandings or mishaps with these weapons in existence? I mean, that can't go on forever. And the Pentagon building missiles now that can carry nuclear or non-nuclear weapons, but nobody who sees them coming will know what's coming. Aren't we doomed by the fact that good luck is going to run out at some point?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's surprising we managed to survive this long, I think. But we've really got to start looking at alternatives resolving the conflicts that we may have that may develop from around the world, using kind of more and more sophisticated weapon systems, or the threat of use of them is not the way. It doesn't solve any problems at all. It just enables people to bully others into submission, or to scare people, or in fact, as you say, if something really does go wrong, then we're kind of dooming the whole world to misery for generations, maybe even extinction.
How does U.S. politics look to you and others in Europe, and as someone who travels? Here in the United States, for many people, building more nuclear weapons and increasing the arms race and developing all these dangerous technologies is perfectly fine, even noble, as long as Obama is president. But pretty soon, the wrong person is going to be president, and then then you're going to have someone who makes crazy comments about wanting more nukes, just like his predecessor, and then it's going to be incredibly dangerous. Is that how it looks to the rest of the world from the outside?
Well, I think it is. Yeah, I think at the moment people were, well, first of all, people couldn't believe that Donald Trump would be elected president. From things that he's been saying, I mean, we know a lot of American people. We know that they're good, decent people, but we also know that some of the more powerful ones are maybe a little different from the ones that we're used to meeting in the street or wherever, as tourists or whatever. So it's kind of, I think people couldn't believe that somebody like Donald Trump could ever be elected as a president. Well, now that's happened, I think people are very worried. They're not really sure they understand where he's coming from, what he's likely to say. He doesn't seem to be very predictable. And when you're the head of a state which has thousands of nuclear weapons ready to be launched at a moment's notice, that's quite scary, really.
So it does look sort of the same from the outside as to Democratic partisans inside the United States. The problem is Trump.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's not just Trump. I think because he'll be talking about these things, and people will be talking to him about these things. It's the corporations really who, as I've mentioned, stand to earn billions of dollars through contracts. For these things, they're the ones who are pushing these kind of technologies, and they're blocking other ways in which conflicts may be resolved, through just people talking through their problems in the United Nations or elsewhere, just trying to understand each other about what the problems are. That can be the only real way forward, as far as I can see. You can't expect technology which just blows things up, which just kills thousands, millions of people, to actually solve a problem. That doesn't solve anything. It just creates more problems.
So this conference in April, the 7th to 9th of April in Huntsville, Alabama, on the weaponization of space, will this be something of a global gathering? Who will be coming, and what can people expect if they sign up to attend?
Yes, I hope we'll be able to attract people from around the world. The Global Network is a global network, as the name says. So we have people coming. We know that people are coming from Europe. I shall be there. We have people from Germany, from Scandinavia, from India, hopefully, where we've just been, or maybe also from Japan. And South Korea, where we have a number of very active people in this kind of field, and they can relate. They will be there. They will come. They will talk about the struggles that they have in their part of the world. As you know, the Pacific region is now kind of very, well, again, another danger area for humanity, really, with the confrontation between the U.S. and China and all the things that are going on there, North Korea, missile defense systems in Japan and South Korea. And so there's all kinds of things that are happening around the world. In Europe, we have this huge U.S. base at Ramstein in Germany, where drone activity is controlled from or relayed through, and all kinds, it's the missile defense headquarters for the European missile defense system, the NATO and U.S. missile defense system. So we will be having reports from all of these different places, as well as what's actually happening in the United States as well. I mean, people will be coming to hear what people's analysis of the new president and the new he's people he's surrounding himself with, really, in his cabinet or whatever. So, there'll be a lot of relaying of information, a lot of trying to understand what the current situation is, and a lot of trying to plan strategies for trying to stop the further militarization and weaponization of space.
And on top of all that, you will have some sort of act of protest?
Yes, I don't think it's quite clear yet, because that will obviously depend upon what people who are hosting us will be wanting to do or able to do. So there'll be something. We always like, I think, to put some kind of action on the agenda, if we can, to show solidarity with the local people who are there protesting for, you know, all year round. So just to show that we recognise their struggle, we're behind them, we understand what they're trying to do, and we support them. As we go back after that to our own particular places where we're doing something very similar. It's a form of trying to network and get to know each other.
Yeah. And if people want to attend in April in Huntsville, Alabama, how can they sign up to go there?
Well, it'd be wonderful if you could. That would be great. Yes, please go onto the website that you've already mentioned, www.space4peace.org. And there you'll see on the website there'll be a link to the information about the upcoming conference. We haven't got the application forms quite ready yet, but they'll be up there on the website soon with more information. There is a little bit of information up there at the moment, but there'll be more in the next few months as we develop more of the ideas and get more of an idea of who's going to come.
Well, the conference will come together, and the state of the U.S. government will come together. I think we'll know a lot more by April. We have a president, quote-unquote elect, who says he's going to stop the wars of overthrow, end the Cold War with Russia, and so forth, but is bringing in a gang of war hawks and wants increased military spending and is talking about more nukes. I expect, don't you, that we will actually be able to talk much more intelligently about what he means by April.
Yeah, I think that's right. As I say, it's kind of very confusing to people who don't quite understand. As you say, he's saying one thing, the president is saying, or the president-elect is saying one thing, but then building up something that seems to be quite different. So it's really odd. I don't think we understand what's going on. Maybe we'll be able to know more by then and have more of an idea of exactly what route he's taking, although I guess it's fairly clear it's not going to be a particularly good one from the point of view of peace and security.
Well, if it's ending a Cold War with Russia that Obama and Hillary Clinton were stirring up, that would be wonderful. But, you don't get peace by buying more weapons. It hasn't ever worked before.
Right.
So we will see. We've been speaking with Dave Webb. He is the convener of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, spaceforpeace.org. He's on the Coordinating Committee of World Beyond War, chair of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and vice president of the International Peace Bureau. Dave Webb, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I hope to see you in Huntsville.
I hope so, too.
Great. That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the "what could possibly go wrong" meme might be overused, but it's hard not to think it, watching the government create new tools and powers for countering disinformation that will soon be handed to a president-elect who calls journalists the lowest form of life. Donald Trump didn't create the present terrain, however, and pretending that fear-mongering and watch lists and looking the other way are all newly minted will not serve us. In fact, we can look to history to help us understand what's happening and what we can do to resist it. We'll talk history with Ellen Schrecker. She's a retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and the author of a number of books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. This is a kind of which side are you on moment for journalists. Will they defend the rights and liberties of the many communities under threat? Muslims, women, those reliant on government assistance? Will they keep alive a space for dissent and critical questioning in the face of a White House that declares itself indifferent to rules about conflict of interest, to pick one, and that threatens revenge on those it calls enemies? Let's just say signs bode poorly. One sign, the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, Gerard Baker, told Meet the Press that it wouldn't be objective to use the word lie to refer to patently false statements from Donald Trump. That would imply a deliberate intent to mislead, Baker explained, and that's lacking, in his view, in things like Trump's claim that thousands and thousands of Muslim Americans celebrated the attacks of September 11, 2001. It's up to the reader, he contended, to weigh that statement against the fact that nobody has ever found any evidence of it whatsoever. The Journal has run articles containing criticism of Trump. That's presumably why he called it a piece of garbage at a campaign rally. Baker called that strange tough love, suggesting he has a creative relationship to language generally. Note this isn't a new thing. In 2004, Fair reported a talk in which the New York Times' Elizabeth Buemiller and Susan Page of USA Today detailed how they construct absurd word salads to avoid breaking what they present as a firm rule. In Buemiller's words, you can't say the president is lying. Quote, you can say Mr. Bush's statement was not factually accurate. You can't say the president is lying. That's a judgment call. Close quote. Over the increasingly outraged murmurs of the audience of journalism students, Page underscored that idea, adding, quote, I think it's much more powerful to say, however, the president's statement did not reflect the record, close quote. Keep in mind, both outlets are comfortable saying other people are lying. It's only when it comes to some of the most powerful people on the planet that the rules change. Another sign, The Washington Post's Paul Farhi reports that the nation's newspapers are stumped by even conservative columnists' unwillingness to endorse Donald Trump or his ideas. And rather than explore and explain that, they think the answer is to dig up folks who will. We struggled to find voices that would advocate for Trump, the New York Times editorial page editor says. I'm still waiting for pro-Trump op-eds to come in, says his counterpart at the Des Moines Register. Our editor ought to be aggressively seeking smart, articulate people who have positive things to say, says the LA Times. USA Today solved the problem, we're told, by getting Trump and Pence themselves to write for them. Maybe the New York Times will adopt that strategy, given its editor's statement that his paper could have done better. And of a piece with that, NBC has decided that in seeking talent for their news division, a good place to look is Fox News. Megyn Kelly will soon host a daytime news show, anchor an in-depth Sunday night news show, and take part in NBC's special political programming and event coverage. Kelly was subjected to the creepy predations of Fox head Roger Ailes and, of course, was the target of Donald Trump for daring to broach his overt sexism in a debate question. But one wonders what was so attractive about her journalistic record. Was it the doggedness reflected in the 45 segments she dedicated to conspiracy mongering that the new Black Panther Party was carrying out a campaign of voter intimidation and anti-white racism, all of it green-lighted by the Justice Department? Or her repeated dismissal of racism as a factor in police violence, a topic she often discussed with favored guest, the LAPD's Mark Furman? Or her reference to the, quote, anti-cop thug mentality, close quote, she detected in Black communities. Or maybe it was the journalistic mettle Kelly evidenced with her insistence that Santa Claus is white. She was firm on that one, adding, quote, Jesus was a white man, too. He's a historical figure, and that's a verifiable fact, as is Santa, close quote. Yes, Santa is white, and Trump can be a newspaper source on Trump, and there's no such thing as a president lying. Buckle up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. We have major media afroth with tales of Russian hacking of the presidential election, giving millions of Americans the idea that Russian agents actually tampered with voting machines. A Democratic president just signed off on something called the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act, tasked to aim communications at foreign audiences to counter-message the ideas of state-defined terrorists and other extremists in the information space. That was part of the National Defense Authorization Act, a previous iteration of which eliminated parts of the Smith-Mundt Act that prevented the U.S. government from propagandizing domestic audiences. And while legislation making its way through Congress sets up an interagency committee empowered to target Russian media manipulation, along with such other duties as the president, that would be Trump, may designate, a new website purports to serve as a watch list on professors deemed guilty of advancing leftist propaganda in the classroom. The Washington Post trumpets a completely unfounded story about Russians hacking the electrical grid in Vermont a few weeks after promoting a report by an anonymous group on websites accused of purveying fake news in service of a Russian campaign to undermine American interests. And the Wall Street Journal declares it wouldn't be objective to use the word lie when referring to Donald Trump's false statements. It is quite a moment. And while not everything old is new again, it's better not to pretend this is this country's first excursion into enemies' lists and official encouragement to ferret out the insufficiently patriotic. The first inclination is to evoke the McCarthy era. In what ways does and doesn't the present moment echo that time, and what are the threads that connect that not-so-long-ago period to today? We're joined now by Ellen Schrecker, now retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and author of, among other titles, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. She joins us by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ellen Schrecker.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, I know that that introduction was sort of overwhelming. I meant it to be. I think folks are feeling overwhelmed. It's almost a key feature of the present moment. And that feeling, who do you trust? Is the enemy of my enemy my friend? That feeling can be instrumentalized, if you will. Confusion and fear lead people to accept things and do things that they might not do otherwise. When we think about McCarthyism, we tend naturally enough to think about Joe McCarthy. But I wonder, do you think in a way that the lessons such as they are might lie less in him than in what that time brought out in other people?
Very much so. McCarthy was a convenient figurehead. He was an aberrant personality. He was a guy who knew how to play the press brilliantly. But actually, he came rather late to the movement that he gave his name to. He didn't really surface until 1950, by which point there had been years of hearings by the House Un-American Activities Committee. The federal government had imposed a very ideological loyalty security program on its employees. McCarthyism, in other words, was going full steam even before McCarthy showed up at the station. And I think the main thing that we have to be careful about is not to confuse McCarthy with McCarthyism, because McCarthyism was a much broader movement. And similarly, not to sort of think that Trump is everything that is happening today, because I think what is happening today is the fruit of 40 years of a concerted right-wing conservative effort to delegitimize a lot of what we would consider liberal moderate orthodoxy, to delegitimize things like climate change, for example, which, you know, is pretty scary. McCarthyism was the same way. What we saw in the 1950s was a very broad-based movement designed ostensibly to eliminate all the influence of American communism and all the people involved with it and the ideas and the organizations connected to it, to eliminate that from American life. Now, there were communists. I mean, one of the myths of the McCarthy period was that McCarthy and the HUAC and all the other sort of second tier witch hunters were targeting innocent people. Well, they were and they weren't. These people were certainly innocent of crimes. They hadn't done anything wrong. But politically, these were people on the left. These were people, many of them, probably the vast majority of them, the people who were called up by committees or blacklisted, had some connection to the American Communist Party, and who were still willing to defy the status quo, the sort of standard Cold War consensus, enough to refuse to name names, to refuse to collaborate with this witch-hunting machine. And it was a machine. And so what we saw was a drive against the left, and one that was incredibly successful. I mean, that's the thing that we can't just sort of say, look at the 1950s and say, oh, McCarthy, you know, he was censored by the Senate. Everything turned out fine. Well, everything didn't turn out fine. We ended up with a war in Vietnam, among other things. But also what had happened was that the American political spectrum narrowed, that a whole bunch of ideas and causes kind of disappeared from American political discourse and American political life. And I can give you examples from the labor movement that stopped trying to organize white-collar workers, for example, or from the civil rights movement, which in the late 1940s had a very strong kind of economic justice component. And that was completely wiped out, largely because many of the people who were pushing this broader notion of what civil rights was did have some communist connections, were concerned about issues of economic class, and were simply booted out of the civil rights movement, the mainstream civil rights movement, which was trying to protect itself against some very ferocious red baiting. So what we see as a result of McCarthyism, is a much narrower range of political ideas that impoverish the American political scene and put a stop to creating a much stronger safety net, for example. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it now with an attempt of the Republicans to roll back Obamacare. Well, back in the late 1940s, President Truman wanted to get the equivalent of Medicare for all. You know, he wanted a full federal financing of health care, the same as that exists throughout much of the industrialized world. But he was attacked. It was considered, quote unquote, socialized medicine, and it has yet to return to American politics.
Yes, you hear folks now saying we'll survive this, you know, like we survived McCarthyism. I mean, we post-date it, you know, but there were, I think we forget that there were costs, you know, that actual people and actual, as you point out, causes were hurt. There was fallout there, and it's not simply enough to say, well, we're going to get through it as though there's no damage.
Right. I think that's very true. And what I would like to emphasize is one of the reasons there was so much damage and one of the reasons why so many people lost their jobs and even more people just shut up. I'll give you one example of this is I taught late 20th century American history, U.S. since 1945 was my main course. And I would talk about McCarthyism, and then I would ask my students to talk about the anti-war movement against the Korean War, which began in 1950 and was every bit as unpopular, according to the polls, as the Vietnam War was, but we don't know that mm-hmm. very well. And I would be greeted by silence in my classes, and I'd say, yeah, that's the right answer. In other words, McCarthyism had thoroughly prevented any attempt to criticize the Korean War. In my writing, I always sort of say, well, wait a minute, what about the books that weren't written, the movies that weren't made, the unions that weren't organized? In other words, the damage from McCarthyism is not just people losing their jobs or going to jail, but all of the movements, all of the projects, all of the books and ideas that weren't out there in American life. And that's the kind of thing that's very scary because we'll never know.
Right.
What I think is responsible for a lot of that and a lot of the self-censorship, which was really ferocious during that period, was the collaboration of what we could see as the moderate middle, the willingness not just of politicians or journalists, but university presidents and hospital administrators, all kinds of people, to go along with McCarthyism, to somehow buy into the notion that the Constitution protected everybody but communists. And so what we got in the 1950s was institution after institution within civil society, all the way up to and including the Supreme Court, refusing to defend the rights of individuals who were attacked during this period and operating on the assumption that somehow if you were named by HUAC and took the Fifth Amendment, there was something wrong with you. And people knew better. That was what gave McCarthyism so much power, was this collaboration of the employers, of the mainstream media, of the legal system, you name it, to go along with this anti-communist purge.
Well, I remember hearing a talk long ago by Robert Kuttner in which he talked about the abandonment of professional ethics. And this is in the 90s, I guess, or early 2000s.
Yeah.
He was talking about, you know, lawyers saying, okay, I can squint and make the law say that torture is okay. You know, doctors saying, okay, I can make force-feeding prisoners at Guantanamo square with my Hippocratic Oath. You know, there's no competing ethics with that is set out by political power, you know, and that does more than undermine resistance. I mean, there's no kind of alternate set of values in evidence for people.
Exactly. Although, to their credit, one has to say, the liberals did wake up. Mm-hmm. You know, it took a while. It took really until the mid to late 50s for the Supreme Court to begin to rule that some of the practices of the Red Baiters were wrong, for the civil rights movement to pick up again, although in a somewhat attenuated way. Right. There was no longer this stress on economic justice, but rather on sort of legal rights and civil rights, important as they were. It wasn't the whole story of racial inequality in America by any means.
Right.
I think the important thing is to avoid going along with these watch lists. And there is hope.
Let me ask you about that hope, because the word watch list itself, I think, for many people sends a shiver. But at least with regard to universities in particular, we are seeing pushback. So let me just draw you out on that. Where are you seeing resistance?
Okay. Well, I am seeing resistance in a number of places. With regard to some of these threats, shall we say, to civil liberties and civil rights, one of the most alarming ones is this notion of a registry of American Muslims. And what we're hearing from a number of groups and individuals is what I call the King of Denmark moment, which comes from the experience during World War II when the Third Reich, Hitler, invaded Denmark and forced all the Danish Jews to wear yellow stars, and the King of Denmark put on a yellow star as well, mm-hmm. obviously showing a great deal of courage there. And we are hearing a number of groups and individuals saying, well, if it comes to that in this country, I'm going to register as a Muslim too. Mm-hmm. We've actually seen that happen within the academic community, with this professor's blacklist that was published, started out some 200 names. It's a weird little list because it doesn't by any means list all the more serious leftists and political activists within the academic community. It seems to be a kind of hodgepodge, I think, many of them probably right-wing students who just sent in the names of professors who gave them Cs. But anyhow, that list was published, and I began getting some interesting things in my inbox, including a letter that was sent from about 100 faculty members at Notre Dame, which is very interesting. It's a Catholic school. You know, you would expect the faculty there to be rather conservative. But here come the Fighting Irish. And they sent a letter or an email to the blacklisting organization saying, put us on the list. And then I know that professors at the University of Michigan began to do the same thing. And then an organization called the American Association of University Professors that I had been active with, that is the main sort of guardian of academic freedom, the main institutional guardian of academic freedom in this country, sent a letter to its members telling us all where to send our names in as well. So there is pushback, and more pushback than there had been during the McCarthy period. For example, during the McCarthy period, the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, simply didn't do a thing. About 100 faculty members were fired, and the AAUP, which had been theoretically supposed to look into these cases, didn't lift a finger. And we saw that throughout American society. The ACLU, for example, during the McCarthy period, would not defend anybody who had been a member of the Communist Party, unless they had recanted seriously. I don't think you'd see that today. I do think that some of these organizations are much wiser and more willing to fight back. But, and let me emphasize this point, there are ways in which it's much worse. And that's because of the way in which institutions like the universities, and I'm particularly concerned about the universities, have been completely hollowed out over the past 40 years. There have been structural changes, many of them motivated by politically conservative movements to crack down on universities, and it's done through defunding, through state legislatures no longer as willing to support higher education as they had been in the 1950s.
Right. Any final thoughts?
Well, I think the main thing is really to remember above all that what we're seeing is the result of a 40-year assault on the sort of liberal mainstream. It's not an assault on the left like McCarthyism, but rather on the American mind, if I can put it that way. And so what we're seeing is people in power now, probably sponsored in one way or another by corporate interests. Certainly, we know that climate denial has very strong ties to the oil and gas industry. And it's this kind of corporate ideological assault on reality, as it were, that is so dangerous and that, you know, is not just Trump.
We've been speaking with Ellen Schrecker. Her most recent book is The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. Ellen Schrecker, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's funny how things build up, how they leak out, finally reaching us. A couple returned to my village from their winter in the Philippines. She grew up there. She is Filipino. They had never been so hot and so dry. They are religious, and they prayed for at least a cloud to get relief from the relentless sun. Then I get an email from a radio friend abroad. He's Robin Upton, the producer who revived the deep alternative show Unwelcome Guests when Lynn Gary retired. Google it, or go to unwelcomeguests.net. As an aside, Robin said the heat was in the unbearable range, over 35 degrees C or 95 Fahrenheit. That became the daily normal, flaring up above that from time to time. Upton was writing from his adopted home in Bangladesh. A headline flickered in my brain, a one-off story asking if India was experiencing the worst drought ever, and they've had some doozies. Or maybe it was just the worst since 2002. Hundreds are dying of the heat. Fields have burned off dry. The only hope for millions, maybe hundreds of millions, is an above-average monsoon season this June to September. May the rains come. In the meantime, in parts of the state of Maharashtra, a criminal law forbids more than 5 people at a time at any water supply. The authorities fear conflict, maybe violence. Vietnam flashes up in my news and Twitter feed. Along with India and Bangladesh, Vietnam is going through a hot, punishing dry period. The country is normally a major rice exporter. This year, not. A band of suffering has taken over South Asia. Yes, it's partly because of El Nino, but a super El Nino, adding its might to the upward pace of global warming. That is one of the world emergencies being blotted out of our minds and screens by endless celebrity trivia and fake political choices. During this past week, climate scientist Paul Beckwith ventured into our darker places. Paul is frustrated with scientists who are constantly surprised that the climate beast is roaring already in so many ways. The global community has had 21 COP meetings, the conference of the parties to a treaty that has done nothing to stop escalating emissions and committed to a climate-damaged future. Maybe, Paul wonders, a regional nuclear exchange between that hot, dry India and Pakistan would stir up enough dust to block just enough sun to cool us down for a few years. The dust of a decent-sized explosion would spread throughout the northern hemisphere, likely cooling the planet an astounding 1 to 1.5 degrees within weeks. It might put a halt to the wildly growing melting of Greenland. The cooling might save at least the last of the reflective Arctic ice cap. Paul explains we have lots of nuclear weapons. It wouldn't cost anything. Just one big one from Russia or America would do the job as well. The cooling would last at least 5 years, maybe 10. Of course, then the world would jump up to new heat levels because we've just hidden another 10 years of huge greenhouse gas emissions under that nuclear cloud. Maybe we'd have to blow off 2 the next time and so on. As Beckwith stands in front of a screen explaining nuclear winter, I spy in the right-hand corner another graphic. It explains the nuclear explosion would also demolish most of the protective ozone layer in the northern hemisphere. People who go outside without wearing a protective bag would ratchet up their risk of cancer coming soon. Everyone would have to wear eye protection to prevent blindness, at least everyone who could afford the special sunglasses. The whole project goes crazy, and Paul knows that. I think he's just telling us how serious the climate shift is, how we are deluding ourselves about climate action, and the fact that we are not ready to cool the planet in this emergency. All this brings me to James Hansen. Many of you know Dr. Hansen, the former director of the Goddard Space Center of NASA. He's the man who warned the U.S. Congress about dangerous climate change in 1988. He's struggled with this threat ever since. Last summer, Hansen and a collection of prestigious academics around the world broke scientific protocol by publicly speaking about their research. Paul Beckwith did a series of 9 videos at that time to explore and explain what Hansen and his co-scientists were saying. Find that video series on YouTube or at paulbeckwith.net. This March, the group officially published their study. It's about ice melt, and it's about major storms, and it's about sea level rise. It got some press. It's huge. Why haven't I said anything about it on Radio EcoShock? There are problems. First of all, I invited Dr. Hansen to appear on this program. I got no reply. He's crazy busy. I have no inside track to reach him. Hansen can pick his world media for appearances, maybe the New York Times or the BBC. Secondly, there's been a fairly strong chorus of criticism of this paper from other scientists. Of course, a few complained that the process was broken. But Hansen says this scientific warning is much too important to wait a year before telling the population what is coming. Other scientists simply disagree either with his conclusions or his method of reaching them. A few have said, for example, that Hansen and team did not reach their vision of an ultra-stormy future in a ruined atmosphere by using models. But then Hansen explains the weakness in all models, including his. The paper refers to evidence of superstorms that could move 1,000-ton boulders inland from the shore. We can see these mysterious boulders on Caribbean islands. This is part of the paleoclimate record, but there are questions about how the Hansen team connected those times to these times. It is possible that the vision of dangerous and damaged decades to come was assumed rather than proven, and Hansen talks about his assumptions. At that point, and really before then, I realize I'm just not skilled enough to judge. Plus, I think Hansen can be mistaken at times. I think his promotion of nuclear energy as a solution to global warming is deeply mistaken. That is partly why I haven't covered this story. Another angle is the deep feeling that I might not be able to bear knowing what Hansen knows. You see, we've all been sold a picture of slowly developing climate change. In countless interviews, scientists have cautioned that melting glaciers like Greenland and Antarctica will take hundreds of years at least. The global mean temperature has only been going up slowly. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is discussing how we can still burn more fossil fuels in the next couple of decades. Maybe we'll peak and gradually come down with quite survivable impacts. The seas will only rise slowly, they say. It's the mantra of changes in geologic time. If James Hansen is right, all this is wrong. The stakes are enormous, far larger than anything humans have ever experienced, bigger than the Earth has seen in more than 50 million years. The speed of change may be absolutely new. I'm slowly collecting my files and links on the Hansen paper. He's gone to the press saying, James Hansen is not an extremist. The science is what it is. The rapid changes we are seeing today speak loudly. On March 21st, Hansen put out a video on YouTube explaining the work. It's 15 minutes long. If I can't interview the man, we still need to hear him speak. Here is Dr. James Hansen with Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, the video abstract.
Hi, I'm Jim Hansen, Director of the Climate Science Awareness and Solutions Program at Columbia University Earth Institute. I want to discuss some implications of the paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, that is being published in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics, a paper on which I have 18 exceptional American and international co-authors. We have uncovered information and a partial understanding of feedbacks in the climate system, specifically interactions between the ocean and the ice sheets. These feedbacks raise questions about how soon we will pass points of no return, in which we lock in consequences that cannot be reversed on any time scale that people care about. Consequences include sea level rise of several meters, which we estimate could occur this century, or at latest next century, if fossil fuel emissions continue at a high level. That would mean loss of all coastal cities, most of the world's large cities, and all their history. A more immediate threat is the likelihood of shutting down the ocean's overturning circulations in the North Atlantic and Southern Oceans. That's where superstorms come in. Let me explain. We use climate modeling, paleoclimate data, that's Earth's ancient climate history, and modern observations of the ocean and ice sheets to study effects of ice melt on Greenland and Antarctic ice shelves, tongues of ice extending from Antarctica into the Southern Ocean. Greenland and Antarctica are beginning to melt because of global warming. So far, it's just a tiny, tiny fraction of the ice sheets that has melted. However, this fresh meltwater spilling out onto the North Atlantic and into the Southern Ocean already is having important effects. We conclude that light fresh water added to the upper layers of the ocean is already beginning to shut down North Atlantic deep water formation and Antarctic bottom water formation. This will have enormous consequences in future decades if full shutdown is allowed to occur. United Nations IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, does not report these effects for two reasons. First, most models used by IPCC simply exclude ice melt. Second, we conclude that most models, ours included, are less sensitive than the real world to added fresh water, because most models have excessive small-scale ocean mixing, which reduces the effect. The surface manifestation of slowdown of the deep circulations is cooling in the North Atlantic southeast of Greenland and in the Southern Ocean. These coolings are prominent in our model by the middle of the 21st century. However, on multiple grounds, we conclude that the real world responds faster to fresh water than the models do. First, let's note that North Atlantic cooling, if the overturning circulation shuts down entirely, will have large effects. The tropics continue to warm as CO2 increases. If Greenland freshwater shuts down deep water formation and cools the North Atlantic several degrees, the increased horizontal temperature gradient will drive superstorms stronger than any in modern times. All hell will break loose in the North Atlantic and neighboring lands. Such a situation occurred in the last interglacial period, 118,000 years ago. The tropics were about 1 degree warmer than today because Earth's spin axis was tilted less than today. Ocean core data show that deep water formation shut down. The North Atlantic cooled, and there's evidence of powerful superstorms at about that time, powerful enough for giant waves to toss 1,000-ton megaboulders onto the shore in the Bahamas. Some scientists think these boulders may have been tossed by a tsunami, but we present multiple lines of evidence that the boulders and other geologic features are best explained as the result of superstorms. An important point is that if we let ice melt from Greenland become large enough to fully shut down the AMOC, the Atlantic Overturning Circulation, it will be permanent as far as the public is concerned. It takes several centuries for AMOC to get moving again. However, superstorms will not be the most important consequence of global warming if it continues to grow. The most important effect will be sea level rise. Here, too, the most complete analysis must account for paleoclimate data, which shows that ice sheets, when they disintegrate, can go quickly, nonlinearly, yielding multimeter sea level rise in a century. Even when the climate forcing is weaker than the human-made climate forcing. We show that from paleoclimate data that most ice sheet models are more lethargic than the real world, in which sea level is known to have risen rapidly many times. So instead of using an ice sheet model, we simply assume that when warming occurs driven by a growing climate forcing, the rate of ice melt will grow nonlinearly. We test several alternative growth rates. What we find are amplifying feedbacks, just what is needed to feed nonlinear ice melt growth. Greenland meltwater reduces the density of surface water, thus reduces sinking of water to the deep ocean. As meltwater grows, it shuts down the ocean conveyor, as Wally Broker calls it. More important for sea level is what is happening around Antarctica. Sinking of heavy, salty, cold water near the Antarctic coast normally forms Antarctic bottom water, thus also bringing relatively warm water to the surface, where it releases heat to the atmosphere and space. Now, as fresh meltwater from Antarctic ice shelves increases, it tends to put a cold, low-density lid on the Southern Ocean. This reduces exchange with the surface, so the heat stays in the ocean, raising the temperature of ocean water at the depth of ice shelves and amplifying feedback. In a global perspective, cold freshwater lenses around Antarctica increase the planet's energy imbalance. The added energy goes into the ocean, where it is available to melt ice shelves. These feedbacks support our conclusion that melt in response to strong forcing will be nonlinear. These feedbacks, with meltwater driving subsurface warming, also help us understand and gain a consistent picture of rapid nonlinear climate oscillations in the paleoclimate record. Paleoclimate data makes clear that when ice sheets melt, they can go fast. However, we do not know the characteristic time for the nonlinear ice sheet response to growing climate forcings. Eventually, ice sheet models may give us an answer, but for now, our best guide is observations. Unfortunately, records of growing annual mass loss by the ice sheets are short. The Greenland data can be fit as well by 10-year or 20-year doubling times. But already, Greenland is losing several hundred cubic kilometers of ice per year. Feedbacks for Greenland with its surface melt are different than for Antarctica, but there are several amplifying feedbacks. Greenland responds to global warming will be nonlinear, but likely with a different characteristic doubling time. Antarctic mass loss is smaller. Most melting so far is ice shelves, which does not show up in gravity satellite measurements of mass change. However, as ice shelves disappear, the discharge of the non-floating ice will accelerate. If ice sheet mass loss has a 10-year doubling time, meter-scale sea level rise would be reached in about 50 years, and multimeter sea level rise a decade later. 20-year doubling time would require about 100 years. The data records are too short. But if we wait until the real world reveals itself clearly, it may be too late to avoid sea level rise of several meters and loss of all coastal cities. I doubt that we have passed a point of no return, but frankly, we are not certain of that. There's an analogous, but I believe more imminent, situation with shutdown of overturning ocean circulations. The cold regions southeast of Greenland and around Antarctica are signs of the beginning of shutdowns of the AMOC in the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean SMOC. We note that effects of meltwater seem to be occurring one or two decades earlier in the real world than in our model. Why would models be less sensitive to today's ocean's meltwater amounts? We present evidence for excessive small-scale ocean mixing in many models, including ours. One key diagnostic is the climate response time. In 100 years, our model achieves only 60% of its equilibrium response. I have checked three other major climate models, two American and one British, finding similar slow response. However, we have shown that Earth's measured energy imbalance requires the 100-year climate response to be about 75% if equilibrium climate sensitivity is about 3 degrees Celsius, as paleoclimate data show it to be the case. The explanation for why the surface response is so slow in the model is that the model ocean mixes heat too rapidly into the deeper ocean. This same excessive mixing causes the models to be less sensitive to the freshwater lens on the ocean surface, which also tends to mix too fast. There is other data besides Earth's energy imbalance supporting this interpretation, including the sensitivity of paleoclimate to freshwater forcing. However, there's one recent paper that is especially important by Winton and co-authors in 2014 who show that a model with a tenth of a degree spatial resolution, fine enough to resolve small-scale ocean motions and avoid parameterized mixing, yields a surface temperature response about a quarter larger after 50 to 100 years, consistent with our interpretation. It would be valuable if all models would report their surface climate response function, as well as their equilibrium climate sensitivity, and examine the model sensitivity to a standard, rapidly increasing rate of meltwater ejection. The relevance is that I believe we are already witnessing the beginning of this cooling southeast of Greenland and cooling around Antarctica in response to freshwater from ice melt. In that case, observed cooling southeast of Greenland and the extra warming along the United States East Coast are not natural fluctuations. When AMOC slows down, it causes both of those. This interpretation implies that Greenland meltwater is already having significant effects. The warm water along the East Coast is the reason that Sandy retained hurricane-forced winds all the way up to New York City area. The nearby Atlantic was about 3 degrees Celsius warmer than normal. This unusually warm ocean water has also been able to provide the moisture for recent record snowstorms. These are small effects compared to what happens if AMOC shuts down entirely. So the question arises again, have we passed a point of no return? Is ice melt sure to increase so that AMOC shutdown is a foregone conclusion? I doubt it, but it's conceivable, depending on how fast we slow down human-made climate forcing. I think the conclusion is clear. We are in a position of potentially causing irreparable harm to our children, grandchildren, and future generations. This is a tragic situation because it is unnecessary. We could already be phasing out fossil fuel emissions if only we stopped allowing the fossil fuel industry to use the atmosphere as a free dumping ground for their waste. If we collected a gradually rising fee from fossil fuel companies, we could phase over to clean energies. If done right, it would spur the economy and create jobs. But that's a story for another day. But I want to make one final point. This is a complex story, but one with important practical implications. I find that the public sometimes misinterprets our science discussions, how research is done. Skepticism is the lifeblood of science. You can be sure that many scientists, indeed most scientists, will find some aspects in our long paper that they would interpret differently. That's entirely normal. It takes time for conclusions to be agreed upon and details sorted out. So after you have talked to a scientist about this topic, ask him or her a final question. Do you agree that we have reached a dangerous situation? Do you think we may be approaching a point of no return, a situation in which our children inherit a climate system undergoing changes that are out of their control, changes that will cause them irreparable harm? That's the bottom line. Thanks for listening.
That was Dr. James Hansen, formerly with NASA, and a leading scientific voice on climate change. In a way, he spoke partly to other scientists, I think. The full impact of what could happen is not explained for the public, although I suppose for a scientist of his caliber to warn all hell will break loose in the North Atlantic, that's pretty clear. Losing most of our coastal cities by the end of this century is plain enough. The time of great storms is left to our imagination. I'm going to reread this paper, watch another dozen videos maybe, listen to the scientific backtalk. I'll come back to this paper when I know more. Meanwhile, the recording of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at Mauna Loa, Hawaii, hit another frightening record of 409 parts per million. We started at 280 parts per million at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. During most of my life, it has climbed slowly but surely through the 300s. Now it's peaking, so that the new lows will be the old highs. And the new highs have never been seen on Earth for many millions of years. Australia is losing the Great Barrier Reef, or at least parts of it. Greenland has begun its summer melt season in early April. That's another record. Worrying news is pouring in from a wave of scientific papers around the world. My jaw drops, my nerves tingle. at least a dozen times a week. No one can keep up with all this. All I know is that it's coming, and we are sleepwalking into a new, more dangerous world. Sometime soon, or maybe it was yesterday, we reached that limit where the damage can never be undone in thousands of years. We are writing our wills for our descendants. Through our actions and inactions, we promise them a damaged atmosphere with unstable weather and strange seas. The bugs, the plants, and the other animals will move and change if they can. The future of our species cannot yet be written, even by the most imaginative science fiction writers or poets of tragedy. Unless we can pull off a miracle of collective action, and I think that is still barely possible, the future will be distorted beyond recognition. That is the only certainty. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Hi, I'm Alex. This is Radio EcoShock. We talked about the dry heat in East Asia and the possibility of creating dust to cool the world in an emergency. But there is already a long season of smoky haze hanging over a lot of Asia, especially over Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. Unfortunately, that smoke is unlikely to cool anything. It comes from burning tropical forests in the islands of Indonesia. There is black carbon in it, which will soak up sunlight and heat. Even worse, a lot of the fires are actually burning peat, that compact vegetative matter just one step below coal, for carbon pollution. When the biggest peat fires erupted in Indonesia in a previous El Nino of 1997-98, it launched Indonesia into the top three greenhouse gas polluters in the world. The peat fires continue as big corporations and small landholders clear and drain the tropical forests, transforming them into palm oil plantations. I got an email from listener Eugen Lee offering to ask the experts why haze was covering Malaysia and Singapore yet again. Eugen is a master's student studying environmental sciences at the University of Cologne in Germany. He carefully crafted this report for Radio EcoShock.
First and foremost, a big thank you to Alex Smith and Radio EcoShock for hosting this content. My name's Eugen Lee, and I hope to spread awareness of the now annual haze blanketing Southeast Asia. I'm joined in this debate by several experts on the issues surrounding the haze. Dr. Helena Varki, senior lecturer at the University of Malaya, Alan Tan, professor of the National University of Singapore Law School, and Dr. Rachel Carmenta, postdoctoral fellow at CIFOR, the Center for International Forestry Research in Indonesia. Dr. Carmenta, what was the haze like last year?
In 2015, when the fires are extensive and the wind is blowing in the right direction, the haze affects Singapore, it affects Thailand, it affects Malaysia, and locally, obviously, the effects are also significant. There was weeks without sun because the air was sort of a yellow, smoky colour.
How exactly is this haze produced, Dr. Barbie?
There is natural fires, then there's also man-made fires. In the past, before the 1990s, we also had transboundary haze, but not very bad. And this was primarily from either natural fires or slash and burn fires. But in the recent years, with the agribusiness boom, especially in Indonesia and Malaysia, where there's a huge push for oil palm now, this is where we have a more serious haze because the scale is much larger. So nowadays, the source of it, we can say, is largely man-made.
But there are other factors too.
Scarcity of land has pushed the agribusiness sector to target peatland for conversion. Once drained, peat soils become the consummate fuel for haze-producing fires.
So the haze is heavily sort of influenced by wind direction and also the density of the fires burning and what land they're burning, because peatland actually creates more haze than mineral soils.
Peatlands are literally wet and flooded. When plantations come in and they want to develop these peatlands, the first thing they must do is they have to drain the peatland. when these peatlands are usually wet and then they are dried out, they become very fire prone.
Indonesia has been the main source of the haze in recent years, although there are many laws banning the use of open fires, especially in peatland areas. Dr. Varki's work on patronage politics describes what she calls instrumental friendships between the patrons and their clients, that is to say, the political elite and agribusinesses, such as oil palm plantations.
We have a lot of clients, which are agribusiness companies, or rather individuals within these companies, which have connections, which have friendships with political elite, either at the local level or at the central level. You know, at local means the kabupaten level, and central as in the ministry level or even the ministers and all that. So because of these friendships that they have, these plantation companies are able to, number one, get licenses where they're not supposed to get licenses, particularly peatlands. And number two, they are able to, if a fire is found on their property, either they did it purposely or accidentally, they can get away with it. They can either delay the police from coming to investigate, or they can make sure that if a case goes to court, it's usually kicked out very before it gets any decision.
There have been numerous attempts to mitigate the haze in terms of national scale firefighting efforts, as well as the Haze Agreement of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, back in 2002. One recent development was the introduction of the Singaporean Transboundary Haze Act in 2014, which allows Singapore to prosecute haze-producing companies in Indonesia that are headquartered or closely linked to Singapore. Professor Tan describes how this works in more detail.
The maps that show ownership and control of plantation lands are often inaccurate or contradicting. Contradicting meaning that there could be even more than one map, there could be two or three maps issued by different regional governments or different departments that actually show overlapping concessions on the ground. The first legal presumption is that if there are any maps to show that a particular area belongs to a certain company, it shall be presumed under Singapore law that that company owns that piece of land. The second presumption is that if there is meteorological evidence at the time of a particularly bad haze episode in Singapore to show that the winds are blowing generally from the direction of that piece of land in question in the direction of Singapore, it can be presumed under law that the smoke is coming from that particular piece of land. The third legal presumption that completes the puzzle, if you like, is that it shall then be presumed under Singapore law that that offending company will then be responsible for creating that smoke that has drifted into Singapore.
In correspondence with the first presumption regarding accurate maps, Indonesia launched what it called the One Map Initiative in order to reduce ambiguity of plantation concessions. But there are significant hurdles in the way.
Meteorological evidence, including satellite evidence, will be used, but the reality, of course, is that satellite evidence pinpointing the hotspots or the fires that occurred on certain lands cannot always be 100% accurate. Satellite evidence is almost always compromised if there is bad weather, or cloudy, excessive cloud formation.
The relationship of smallholders to plantations is a very complicated thing, actually. A lot of these smallholders and plantations exist in sort of symbiotic relationship with each other. So the plantations sometimes have smallholders on their land as well. And then the smallholders on their land would develop their own trees and sell the plants directly to the plantation. So that is something that it has been going on for many years, and it's sort of like a trend. But in terms of this fire, the thing that we often see is that sometimes plantations take advantage of smallholders in the sense that if a fire does occur on plantations, they usually blame the smallholders.
Well, under the Singapore Transboundary Haze Pollution Act, the companies can be fined up to $1 million and be made to pay a certain amount of fines for every day that the fires continue to burn. So there are some hefty penalties that are prescribed under the Singapore Transboundary Haze Pollution Act. But again, the problem is identifying the actual defendants to prosecute and to ensure that the evidence that's presented before the courts is watertight enough to convince the judges that that particular company is to be held liable for a particularly bad haze episode that's afflicting Singapore.
This act allows Singaporean external investors to be made culpable for their role in causing indiscriminate open fires and therefore haze. But there are many other stakeholders involved and affected. Dr. Carmenta has identified these stakeholders in Riau, a province in Indonesia.
They included sort of the sharecroppers and the landless who were working in the plantations and have some, you know, responsibility for those daily actions of maintaining the plantation and keeping the, applying the fertilizer and all these other, clearing the land, operating the machinery. Then there are also the smallholders, and they range massively in terms of how much land do they have and how much capital also. We tend to talk about a smallholder as though it's one sort of unified group, and actually there's a lot of variation there in power and assets and also in land. We identified the local policy communities, which included the NGOs and the different sort of district level government agencies. We also included the Jakarta-based policy community.
C4 has found some agreement between these stakeholders on how to tackle the problem phase, such as incentives to plant land more quickly in order to reduce the susceptibility of fire in idle forest areas. There are other solutions, but under more contention.
And then the ones which were most contested, but at the same time, on average, most regarded as most effective, they included reflooding peatlands, which would prevent the agricultural expansion that we see, because those crops are not water tolerant. That was regarded as effective, but absolutely contested, because of course the implication then for some of those stakeholders is severe. Another one which is regarded as most effective but contested is revoking road company licenses if they're found to be burning. And then, interestingly, actually, the third was using canals, expanded use of canals as fire breaks and for firefighting. And that's an action that we saw being pursued, but it's one that also there's a lot of disagreement about.
Within areas of agreement for the stakeholders, incentivizing sustainable development is a hot topic. But how can local incentives be created effectively?
Money can be useful, but it has to be directed and targeted at fundamental, sustainable solutions, and not just money to be given to smallholders to tell them not to burn.
With this in mind, the private sector in Indonesia has launched a fire-free alliance with a performance reward scheme.
The community will receive a payment of 100 juta, which is 100 million rupiah, at the end of the year, if they didn't have any fire in their jurisdiction. And then they receive half of that reward if they only had small fires. And then that reward is not paid in cash, but in kind. And so this model is apparently effective. The research hasn't been done yet.
But this initiative is not without its obstacles.
A farmer might want to convert 15 hectares, but actually, if you look at what they have in terms of capital to buy seedlings and to maintain the plot, they couldn't manage, you know, they'd not made that equation in an informed way. And so part of this outreach is helping to make a stronger business plan. And it can only happen, though, if the land tenure is clear. So I know that that's, land tenure has been a problem for the program, because the company can't help a smallholder to clear land unless the smallholder can demonstrate that the land is theirs.
The local economy has also reacted in the way that banks give out loans.
So they don't simply want to give out loans unless you can prove that you have sustainable practice. This is a positive development.
On the international scene, the UN launched its Red Plus, or Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation scheme, in Indonesia in recent years. What does this entail exactly?
Well, Red Plus is a payment for performance. It's ultimately a reward, an incentive for good behaviour. And in this case, it would be for avoiding deforestation and degradation, and now has expanded to include restoration also.
The Norwegians already have a Red Plus project in Indonesia that effectively provides money in order to cordon off certain tracts of land for sustainable conservation purposes and do not have those lands be converted for commercial exploitation. But those projects are still very small scale at the moment and appear to be just drops in the ocean.
We have a paper writing about the importance of including fire in Red Plus, because if you can't account for fire and improve fire management, then that's a big risk to the performance of your project, of your Red Plus initiative. And I, so far as I understand, very few projects in Indonesia do account for fire.
Since his inauguration in 2014, Indonesia's President Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, started a seemingly positive shift towards more pro-environmental behaviour, including the launch of the BRG, the Peatland Restoration Task Force Agency, and the merging of the Ministries of the Environment and Forestry. What does the merger spell for the cooperation of the two ministries in the reduction of fires?
There hopefully is going to be a more of a check and balance where the environmental concerns should also play a role in giving out licenses. But there's also a lot of skepticism because previously, before the Ministry of Environment was part of the Forestry Ministry, the Ministry of Environment was viewed as a very weak ministry without much clout. And the Forestry and Agriculture Ministry usually overrode a lot of the Ministry of Environment's concerns.
Much of the aforementioned work by C4 and Dr. Carmenta on evaluating solutions to the haze will be of great value to the BRG, headed by Pak Nasir. The agency clearly shows that peatland restoration is the focus of Indonesia's move towards fire prevention, but it is not without its teething problems.
Well, the way I understand from speaking with Pak Nasir last week is that the Peatland Restoration Agency actually has no legal weight. And so even like a question that would come before that one would be, how can the Peatland Restoration Agency get these large companies to even rewet any of their land whatsoever? Because they're going to lose. They're going to have to flood their own crops.
Dr. Vahi, is there a best solution?
I think the policies are all there. The laws are all there. But it's just the implementation. And as I said, what makes implementation very difficult is patronage. So it requires a really dismantling of this patronage system. And hopefully the change that is bringing about by Jokowi would be able to bring that. Because Jokowi does not come from any traditional long-serving political family. So he's a bit outside from the network.
Professor Tan.
Well, I don't think that this act can prescribe a long-term solution. They really require deep-seated reform of land use policies, of forest and land use management within Indonesia itself. But the reality is that the oil palm and pulp and paper plantations continue to generate a lot of revenue for the Indonesian economy. And so that essentially comes in the way of the Indonesian authorities clamping down hard on these actors for their offending activities.
Dr. Carmenta?
I think it's clear that there will have to be a mix of improved sanctioning, better designed incentive structures, stronger governance and enforcement. That would be facilitated by some clarity on land tenure. And then, of course, it will be no one size fits all because the landscapes vary in terms of what stakeholders are present. And one incentive structure for one stakeholder is not necessarily going to be appropriate for another.
And finally, as palm oil is so pervasive in everyday products, can we as consumers have a direct effect on its sustainable production?
Realistically, or if you look at the numbers, most of the palm oil exported from Malaysia and Indonesia, it goes to other parts of the region as well, especially China and India and Middle East. So these consumers, they are not so concerned about where it comes from, whether it's sustainable or not.
That's all we have time for. Thank you so much once again to Dr. Helena Vahi, Professor Alan Tan, and Dr. Rachel Carmenta.
That was Eugene Lee reporting on the problem of continuing haze covering Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia. Under the smoke endangered creatures like the orangutan and tropical plants, some of them rare, are disappearing as the forests are cut and peatlands burn. My thanks to you, Jin, for digging into this with Original Radio for EcoShock listeners. Don't forget you can download this radio report or share it with others using links provided in my blog, posted every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Near the beginning of this program, I mentioned Robin Upton, now a resident of Bangladesh. Robin rescued one of the most popular underground radio shows called Unwelcome Guests. It was founded by New York State resident Lynn Gary, who produced the show for years and years. Unwelcome Guests covers alternative speeches and ideas in depth with a two-hour show each week. You can get it at radioforall.net, that's radio, the number four, all.net, or at unwelcomeguests.net. As we play out this week, you will hear just the start of a full program on the work of Ernest Becker. His book, The Denial of Death, won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction back in 1974, just before Ernest died. Only the Western culture struggles so hard to deny the reality of death, and I think that is directly connected to our parallel denial of abrupt climate change. Goodbye from me, Alex Smith, for this week. Here is the opening of Unwelcome Guests, program number 726.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black.
Becker writes that humans cause evil by wanting to triumph over evil in the quest for immortality.
Our most oppressive and violent and brutal behaviors, Becker says, are responses to our death anxiety.
The core problem is that we've got to invest in these worldviews, and then we've got to defend them. And in defending them, we often end up hurting others.
The most brutal and primitive style of coping with death is to dream that you can master it by killing or destroying other people.
We commit the greatest evil by trying to escape from evil, by trying to create a paradise on earth.
We are literally looking for things to label evil, so that once we've done that, we can fight them.
Today, our nation saw evil.
We will not rest until this evil is driven from our world.
And I will not allow the people of this country to be intimidated by evil cowards.
We demonize folks. We see them as the all-encompassing repositories of evil, the removal of which would make life on earth as it is in heaven.
So more people have been killed in the name of God and country than by all the serial murderers put together. It's just a drop in the bucket compared to how much killing has gone on out of loyalty, patriotism, love for God and country.
You're listening to episode 726 of Unwelcome Guests, The Flight from Death. I'm Robin Upton. Exceptionally this week, we begin with a dedication. This show is dedicated to Lily Pierce, a young woman whom I never met, but without whose tragic death on the roads, I would not have made this show. In 2013, an Unwelcome Guests listener, David Pierce, recommended a book to me that he had been recommended after his daughter's tragic death, Ernest Becker's Denial of Death, and at the time, perhaps due to my mother's cancer, I wasn't very assiduous in seeking a PDF or an audiobook, and I let the matter slip. Well, I've now followed the matter up and am very glad that I did so, because I think that book is nothing less than a masterpiece. I can quite understand why the academic establishment didn't really want to have much to do with it at the time. Not helped, of course, Ernest Becker, labelled a cultural anthropologist for the sake of having a label on him, took a very cross-disciplinary and, I think, commendably honest approach, seeking wisdom from all quarters, which he brought to bear on the central topic of the fear of death. His main contention being, while our own mortality and fear of death is not much talked about, it is nevertheless an extremely important topic, much thought about and psychologically repressed. Now, if that sounds slightly wishy-washy, hand-wavy, well then I haven't done the man justice. His book is tightly argued, well-referenced, and cites a lot of other great thinkers from different academic disciplines, principally psychology, also philosophy, cultural anthropology, literature, a wide range. As an introduction to Becker's thought, I've found a 90-minute film, The Flight from Death, which I'm going to be adapting for this show. I thought, let's begin with the voice of David Pearce. This is from an interview in 2012. The full interview is linked from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/726. We're just going to hear one short question, and this is from the Future Primitive podcast.
Please talk about a practical way in which a person who is not in grief can communicate and be helpful to someone who has had a great grief.
That's a fine question, because it's most difficult for those who have not experienced some sort of a deep disconnection with everything that they knew before to really relate to this, because we are all sort of trained unconsciously from the time we're small children to act and think a certain way in Western culture. And it's different in some of the other countries and cultures. Norway is in some ways a lot more open to the ideas of grieving and recognizes that. Villages in Africa and in South America, some of the Latin countries, the Central American countries, and Spain, Italy, they're a bit more open to everyone being sort of aware that people die and grieve. In the United States, not so much. Death is often talked about. Movies, horror films, jokes about death and that kind of thing, but never really seriously. In fact, later on, after Lily died, I realized that those are a way of sort of talking about death, but avoiding the subject, finding ways to keep it in their minds, but sort of diminish it somehow as a way of kind of triumphing over it without really having to face it. So it's most difficult for people who have not experienced deep grief to relate on the same wavelength. People may think, you know, that they're really sad for the person who has lost a loved one or a friend, and they may genuinely feel sorry for them and want to help, but oftentimes they don't really know where to go.
Now, the longer in the tooth that I get, the more I come to see in Gatto's admonition that the inevitability of death must be an important part of curriculum of what young people learn to become properly educated. And it's one that circumstances taught me. Perhaps that's why I seem to understand this. In any case, I would encourage you, even if you live in a country such as the United States and here in Bangladesh, when I discuss the way in which old people tend to be sent to homes surrounded by people of the same vintage, more or less as a kind of warehousing, the general understanding is that this is a pretty barbaric way to
deal with one's nearest and dearest, and I must say, I tend to agree. Now, just before we hear the film, I think I should point out the main two echoes of Unwelcome Guests' themes that it set off in my mind. Number one, you may not be surprised to hear, is money, how money is a proxy for immortality. They would call it an immortality symbol, something that people can use to quell their fear of death, never mind the fact that it won't work, as they will explain in the film. This fulfills a psychologically calming function. And the second echo is the war on terror, as we heard in episode 721. Those who organize false flags are not just looking at numbers of fatalities, they're also looking to communicate meaning and to instill fear. Well, I can't believe the importance of Becker's work has been lost on those who've spent so long in all those think tanks researching how to make people afraid. Now, this is a radio adaptation of a film which has been posted on YouTube, so if you'd like to watch the film itself and have internet access, then I shall link to the original from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/726.
To have emerged from nothing, to have a name, consciousness of self, deep inner feelings, an excruciating inner yearning for life and self-expression. And with all this, yet to die.
Transcendental Media presents a film by Patrick Shen and Greg Bennick, narrated by Gabriel Byrne. Flight from Death, The Quest for Immortality.
Humankind has always been restless. Never satisfied with our physical limitations, we have always strived for more. With machines, we conquer gravity and travel faster and farther than any other animal. We explore the heavens, the last great frontier.
Landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
And we manipulate our own biology through medical science. In defiance of nature, we have manufactured the means to become rulers of the natural world. What is left to conquer? And are we satisfied? Since time immemorial, we have battled our greatest limitation, one which seems to render our efforts to overcome and conquer insignificant. Every day we participate in a multitude of activities to distance ourselves from harm and death. But beneath the surface, we are aware that these day-to-day strategies are doomed to fail. We will die eventually. And all of this will come to an end. Human beings find themselves in quite the predicament. We have the mental capacity to ponder the infinite, seemingly capable of anything, yet housed in a heart-pumping, breath-gasping, decaying body. We are godly, yet creaturely. It is perhaps the ultimate mystery. We may never know what death really is, and whether it marks the end of everything, or, as many believe, the beginning of something else. Yet we do know that death is something to be avoided. What are we to do with death, and why do we fear it?
Merlin Mowry, Professor of Philosophy and Religion.
If we don't even know what death is, then why should we fear it?
Irvin D. Yalom, Existential Psychotherapist.
The fear of death is absolutely ubiquitous. It's hardwired into us.
For all the things that we don't know about what follows death, There are plenty of things we know about what precedes death to make it unwelcome and even seem like an evil interruption, and that is life itself.
Sam Keen, author and philosopher.
At the gut level, my feeling is death is unacceptable. I did not sign that contract. I looked at the small print and everything else. It's unacceptable. That's just sort of a gut feeling in the sense that we love life. Death is an insult to our spirit.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Electronic Intifada.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. We go now to a presentation about boycott, divestment, and sanctions and the popular movements around the world which are engaged in BDS campaigning. Here in the U.S., there are current legislative efforts to suppress and punish BDS activism, as we talked about in our first segment. In April, the Washington, D.C.-based Palestine Center hosted a talk by Omar Shaker of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Rahul Saxena, a staff attorney with Palestine Legal. Both organizations are in partnership to defend the legal rights of activists to engage with the BDS movement and exercise their rights to free speech. They came together to speak about why BDS is such a powerful tool and how activists can continue to grow the movement in spite of the legislative tactics to undermine it. Many thanks to the Palestine Center for the use of this great audio. And now here's Omar Shaker, followed by Rahul Saxena.
Thank you all for coming. It's a real honor to be back at the Palestine Center. And thank you, Zina and Samira, for all your incredible work here at the center and for organizing this event on such a really important and timely topic. It's also an honor to speak with my colleague, Rahul, who, as you'll hear, has really led the Herculean effort to respond to the wave of anti-BDS legislation that's cropped up over the last couple of years. So it's an honor to speak with you as well. Just to give you a little bit of an overview, in my 20 minutes, what I hope to do is to talk about the context part of the title, and specifically looking historically, comparatively, and theoretically at why boycott, divestment, sanctions is such an effective tool. And that'll sort of provide the backdrop to Rahul's comments around the challenges facing the movement and sort of the reason why I think we see increasing efforts to suppress BDS. And I thank Rahul for taking the pessimistic or the challenges side and the more legal side, allowing me to be a little bit more theoretical in my comments. I will draw on several historical examples, but one that I'll draw from significantly is South Africa, as I was just in South Africa last month and have done a lot of thinking around BDS in that context. I'm going to make three pretty simple points, and then I'll hand it over. And all of those points, I think, underscore why BDS is such an effective tool. And those points are, first, it helps reframe the conversation. Secondly, it changes the calculus of Israeli activists. And third, it mobilizes communities in the international community. So I'm going to go through those three points, and then I'll hand it over to Rahul. So the first point really is that boycott, divestment, and sanctions changes the framework. And what do I mean by that? What I mean about that is in the U.S. context, one of the most significant challenges we face is the perception that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is this thousand-year-old conflict, right? It goes back to the beginning of time. It's about these people that hate each other, religion, ethnicity. It can never be resolved. It's communal hatred at its core. As the logic goes, there's two equal sides, right? There's two narratives or powers and states or powers that are equally culpable. Or in fact, if they're not equally culpable, the Palestinians are more responsible because they're the violent terrorist type. And that logic goes further, right? And it says that each side has its legitimate blind spots. It has claims and that it's only misunderstanding and hatred. And if only the people could come together and dialogue and compromise and listen to the other, then we could have reconciliation and we could have coexistence. Right? Of course, we know that this narrative is simply false for a lot of reasons, right? We know that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is, for the most part, a modern struggle that probably dates back, by most historical accounts, to the late 19th century, over land, resources, and rights. And it's not so different than other post-colonial conflicts that we've seen. And we also know that a simplistic account of two sides overlooks the power dynamic, overlooks the fact that we face a situation of a colonizer and a colonized, an oppressor and oppressed, and we have a single power, right? A single power between the river and the sea that controls the everyday lives of the people that live there. So why is boycott, divestment, and sanction so effective? It's effective because it focuses and it shifts attention to the underlying system, right? It looks at policies and institutions as opposed to tackling a particular state or individuals. It looks at a system of inequality, a system that includes corporations, international corporations, American corporations, Israeli corporations, and even Palestinian corporations in some case. And by doing so, right, it really puts that attention on that unjust system and not on the role of any particular side. So as an international community, when there is when you take on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, what you're essentially doing is saying, look, I'm not Israeli, I'm not Palestinian, right? What I'm doing, though, is saying that I don't have a role to discuss a solution. It's not my job to tell you one state, two state, 14 states. What I can tell you is I'm a part of a church or a university or an academic union, and in that context, I do not want my institution invested in profiting over a system of discrimination and rights abuses. It really takes what's a very distant, far-removed issue and puts it in the terrain of your own specific context. And by doing that, you basically are able to say, look, let the people on the ground, when they're in equality, decide a solution. My job is to try and level that playing field by having that institution I'm affiliated with not actively supporting one side of the conflict. So it puts emphasis on the underlying rights abuse, but it does so using a language and a framework that's universal and inclusive. What it basically says is it's not about me being Palestinian or you being Israeli. It's about ending an unjust system so we can live together as equals. And again, that's not talking about one state, two states. It's talking about what the root injustice is. And this is all happening at the same time that the Palestinian narrative itself is shifting, right? We see the Palestinian narrative moving more and more from a nationalist framework to a more rights-based discourse. So what do I mean by that? I think Ali Abu Netma, in his book One Country, I think has a very powerful anecdote that I think speaks to what's happening in Palestine. In his book, he talks about a 2004 encounter in which a farmer from the Palestinian town of Qalqilia is interviewed. He was displaced by Israel's wall in the West Bank. And in this conversation he has with a PLO legal advisor, he says the following, and I quote, "I don't care anymore about the Palestinian flag. I don't care anymore about the word Palestine. I don't care anymore about symbols. I just want to have the same rights as those settlers across the street. I want to be able to drive down this road. I want to be able to send my kids to the hospital or go on vacation when I want to go on vacation." Ali Abu Netma, reflecting on this incident, writes in his book, and I quote, "Palestinian message and methods must make clear that the target is not the Israeli system, but an unjust system that it's not the Israeli people, but an unjust system that denies one people their rights, identity, and dignity, and condemns the other to live in increasing isolation, fear, and moral corruption." Right? So I think increasingly the Palestinian movement, and it's learning from the international context. If you want to look at the world today, I think you can compare struggles like the Kurdish conflict or the Chechenian conflict or the Kashmiri conflict, ones that have remained nationalist in framework, right, about, you know, fundamentally self-determination, with those, say, like South Africa or, you know, Sudan, which were framed in a universal language, whether it be apartheid or genocide, one that allowed movements to build around. And what we see when we look at Palestinian activists, from hunger strikes by prisoners to bus boycotts, we see a new language who takes their target as the international community, as opposed to historically the Arab world, where the Arab world was seen as the primary actor that was going to bring Palestinian liberation. And I think BDS has succeeded in conjunction with the shift in the Palestinian narrative. And what's an example of this? I think for many of us that went to university in the early 2000s, the framework we dealt with was, well, there's occupation, but there's suicide bombing. It was sort of this two sides, what do I do? Today, if you talk to most college students, that's not the framework. The framework is Gaza attacks, we know Israel's committing abuse, what do we do about it? And that shift, I think, has a lot to do with BDS. So point one is it changes frameworks. The second point I want to make is it changes the calculus of Israel and Israeli politicians. Of course, the purpose of BDS, right? I mean, the reason why you engage in boycott, divestment, sanctions is to put pressure on the stronger party, right? It is the most effective, moral, nonviolent way of exerting a pressure on the stronger power to come to the table and end the policies and rights abuses. And so you want to force them to make that change, right? And it grows out of a history. The history shows us that colonial regimes do not relinquish power without popular struggle and resistance, without sustained international pressure. So, of course, that framework exists. People see it, whether it be looking at Algeria, whether it be looking at South Africa. But people always say, well, Israel's different, right? I mean, Israel won't change its policies. When you boycott and when you do BDS, what it does to Israel is it makes it double down. It makes them want to engage further in the occupation. But I think the reality is different. If you look today at what's happening within the Jewish American movement or even the movement within Israel, you see strong divides over the issue of Israel. Right, you see groups like J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace that are basically telling Israeli officials, even those within the Zionist tent, saying that if you want to preserve Israel as a Jewish democratic state, you need to make progress on the occupation. Because they've learned from history that the longer Israel goes down this road, then the more it threatens a South African model. So what I wanted to do here is to look a little bit at the South African experience, because I think an understudied part of the Israel-South Africa comparison is the way in which the white Afrikaner population in South Africa, the Boer population, came itself to change its own calculus and what led F.W. de Klerk, the last president of apartheid South Africa, to ultimately win that Nobel Prize with Nelson Mandela. That's sort of an understudied part of this example. So I wanted to spend a few minutes talking a little bit about that shift that happened in South Africa, because I think it's very instructive and points to why BDS is successful. But before I do that, just a little bit about South Africa and a little bit about Afrikaners. So Afrikaner, it's a term that refers to the white South African population that came in the 17th century of Dutch origin. And the Afrikaner narrative is similarly, like the Zionist narrative, one that's a narrative of expulsion, persecution, redemption, and rebirth that characterize their struggle. Their narrative starts with a single day in history, April 6, 1652, when they set up on the Cape of Good Hope a colony. Mandela wrote in his book that this is the day white South Africans commemorate the founding of their country, and Africans revile as the beginning of 300 years of enslavement. So a similar type of thing as the Nakba. And if you look back at 19th and 20th century South African history, the Boer population languished, actually, under British colonialism. Actually, the term concentration camp was first used to refer to what the British put the white South Africans in the early 20th century. They initiated a scorched earth policy that destroyed tens of thousands of white South African homes, set up concentration camps, and tens of thousands were killed. This event is at the heart of the white South African narrative. F.W. de Klerk actually once declared, and I quote, "The Anglo-Boer War burnt itself in the collective consciousness of my people, the Afrikaners, like no other event in history." Actually, this history is what made the white South African population determined never again to forego their independence. Not so different than Zionism, their narrative was we need to control a state and be in power, or else we risk being subsumed by forces that dislike us. So in 1948, the nationalists came to power on a platform of formally erecting apartheid in power. And I quote from the Nationalist Party platform from 1948, quote, "The choice between us is one of two divergent courses, either that of integration, which in the long run would amount to national suicide on the part of whites, or that of apartheid, which professes to preserve the identity and safeguard the future of every race." Don Kraus, who's the chairman of the Johannesburg Holocaust Survivors Association, wrote, quote, "What the nationalists were trying to do was protect the Afrikaner. especially after what was done to them in the Boer War, where the Afrikaner was reduced almost to a beggar on returning after the war, whether it was on the battlefield or some sort of concentration camp. They did it to protect the Afrikaner, his predominance after 1948, his culture. Right? I mean, if you replace those terms with Zionist, it's a very similar logic to what's led to the creation of State of Israel and the maintenance of the occupation. Another parallel that people lose between Zionism and Afrikaner nationalism is the role of religion. Mandela once wrote, talking about the Afrikaners, I quote, "Like the Israeli journey to the Promised Land, his was the fulfillment of God's promise and the justification for their view that South Africa should be a white man's country forever." In fact, the Afrikaners compared their flight to the Israeli exodus from Egypt and saw their own republic as a new Israel. In addition, the white South African population reversed the indigenous relationship, right? They thought of themselves as the indigenous people. And they saw themselves as in a tough neighborhood, right, surrounded by uncivilized people. In 1976, South Africa put out a publication. This is a quote from that publication, Apartheid South Africa. "Israel and South Africa have one thing above all else in common. Quote, they're both situated in a predominantly hostile world inhabited by dark people." They used colonial logic and racism. They saw the people around them as inferior. They also had contradictions, right? They were a democracy in a sea of autocracy. They had technology. They sought to hide their encounters with their indigenous population. They actually depict their history, including 1948, as a fight for independence. And when you have that history, the only option you have is to erase the existence of the indigenous population. Of course, everybody remembers Moshe Dayan's famous quote in 1969, reflecting on 20 years of Israel, that the success was replacing old Palestinian villages with the names of Israeli villages. Well, I submit to you a quote from Mandela's autobiography. And he wrote in 1955 about driving in Durban, and this is a quote from his book. Quote, "From Durban, I drove along the coast past Port Shepstone and Port St. John's, small and lovely colonial towns that dotted the simmering beaches fronting the Indian Ocean. While mesmerized by the beauty of the area, I was constantly rebuffed by the buildings and streets that bear the names of white imperialists who suppress the very people whose names belong there." And of course, the last similarity that people forget is they're both obsessed about demographics. The clerk once wrote that foremost among these was our conviction that without apartheid, our people would be swamped by the vast black majority, and that this would inevitably lead to the extinction of our hard-won right to self-determination. So you're probably asking me, Omar, you spent 3 minutes talking about South African history. What does that have to do with BDS? Well, South African officials have some advice for Israelis, actually. Pik Botha, the former South African foreign minister, was asked what advice he would give Israelis about dealing with the struggle. And I quote, "We could explain how we overcame our fear of majority rule and began to realize that majority rule was something in our interest in our long run. If the Israelis are interested, we can, in all humility, explain how we came to the point of transforming our society." BDS, in the South African context, provided the bridge that allowed the Afrikaner population to go from this narrative of victimization, of persecution, of not being able to forego apartheid, which was necessary to protect their national identity, to living in a system of equality because of BDS. How do I know that? F.W. de Klerk again writes, quote, we realized the struggle could not be won by brutal, unconventional operations which were in conflict with common decency and basic morality. No evidence that the assassination of opponents had the slightest effect on the final outcome of the struggle, other than causing further personal suffering and bitterness. De Klerk writes about the moment of watching Mandela take the oath of office, and he writes about this moment. He reflected on his ancestors, his Afrikaner ancestors, and he writes, "The dream they had of being free and separate people with their own right to national self-determination in their own national state in Southern Africa, the ideal to which I myself had clung until I finally concluded that if pursued would bring disaster to all people of our country, including my own." BDS led de Klerk to realize that the best way to preserve the place of Afrikaners in the future of South Africa was to open itself up to a society of equality. That realization saved lives, and it brought him the Nobel Peace Prize. Everybody wants to know, when will the Palestinian Mandela emerge? My question is, when will the Israeli de Klerk emerge? And I think we will see one, and it's because of BDS efforts. So I want to end with my third point, which is BDS also mobilizes people and movements. Hugh Evans, who was an Australian humanitarian, talked about BDS in the following terms. Quote, "History shows us that all protest movements rely on symbols, boycotts, strikes, sit-ins, flags, songs, symbolic action on whatever scale, from the Montgomery bus boycott to wearing a simple wristband. It's designed to disrupt our everyday complacency and force people to think." Right? So the idea is you move out of your everyday and you actually make this conflict, these sets of human rights abuses, something that's a real issue on your campus, in your union. You're debating and you're discussing it because you have a direct affiliation to it. And that mobilizes people, right? I mean, if you look at South Africa, Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop and Nobel Peace Laureate, said, and I quote, "In South Africa, we could not have achieved our freedom and just peace without the help of people around the world, who through the use of nonviolent means, such as boycott and divestment, encouraged their governments and other corporate actors to reverse decades-long support for the apartheid regime." And we're seeing this again in North Carolina and Mississippi in the wave of anti-LGBTQI legislation in place around bathrooms, right? We're seeing Bruce Springsteen and all sorts of leaders, you know, boycott. And although that's symbolic, although not having a show does little to stop to change a bathroom bill, the reality is the accumulation of that pressure together forces, it mobilizes people, supports the movement, and forces leaders to change their calculus. And I'll conclude by saying we're starting to see that in Palestine. If we look at the history of the last decade, again, we used to be stuck in this rut in the early 2000s, post 9/11, after the Intifada in this country, if not being able to advance the conversation. Palestine was a fringe movement on many campuses. Those that worked on this issue could not build coalitions. We could not get co-sponsorship of major departments. That's all shifting, right? We see increasingly diverse groups, all following the call of Palestinian civil society in 2005, 171 NGOs calling for divestment. Today, we see the American Studies Association, other very prominent academic institutions endorsing boycott and divestment. We see student governments across the country. Right, I mean, I did my universities. You heard my studies at Stanford. You heard my introduction. Stanford has a $21.4 billion endowment. Last year, the student government, in the face of widespread opposition, endorsed a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And we're starting to see that take real effects. We have companies like Veolia, like G4S, like SodaStream that are shifting their operations as a result of the pressure they're facing from boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So you're going to hear from Rahul about the rise of anti-BDS legislation. But I want to make this point, and this is really what I'll conclude on, is to say that the reason why increasingly we're seeing Israel advocacy organizations move to anti-BDS legislation is because they're losing on the merits. They're losing the debate on college campuses. They're even losing on their other suppression tactics. In our report that was mentioned, we talk about things like legal threats and lawsuits and academic freedom actions. But they're losing on all fronts. Courts are rejecting their argument. Administrators are refusing more and more to discipline students. So what are these groups doing? As a last-ditch effort over the last year, they've raised money and said, we do one thing well. We lobby legislators. So let's turn to those very legislators and try to have them stop it because nothing else is working. But that's failing. So I want to end with a quote. And then I'll give it to Rahul. And the quote is a piece of hope, because you're going to hear some things that might make you pessimistic from him. So I'm going to leave you with some hope. No? Okay. Well, in any case, I'm still going to leave you with some hope. Israeli human rights lawyer Michael Sefard had an op-ed in Haaretz 2 months ago. And he was addressing the question of how it is that civil society organizations, he was talking about the crackdown within Israel and Palestine, but it's really universal. How is it that they continue to make progress in spite of significant repression? And I'm just going to read his quote, and I'll sit down. Quote, "The answer is simple. The world is driven by diverse forces. We vividly see and feel the political, economic, and military forces daily. But there are also less visible forces, whose mode of operation is less overt. One of them is actually an idea, that all human beings are equal, and that all deserve rights because they're human beings. That idea is responsible for the greatest and most important revolutions in history. It's an idea that operates like dark matter in the universe. in silence. And it, together with those who oppose the occupation, is pushing us to end the occupation and to bring about a substantive change in the way Israeli society functions. It vests these ostensibly small and weak organizations with inexplicable might. And it will bring an end to the occupation. Thank you.
The electronic intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Silverstein of the progressive blog Tikkun Olam, who explains why he believes the Obama administration's break with Israel at the United Nations over settler expansion was too little too late. Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who discusses the grave threat he believes the incoming Trump administration poses to civil liberties. And Steve Palumbi, Professor of Marine Sciences at Stanford University, who talks about how rising ocean temperatures due to climate change are bleaching and killing many of the planet's vital coral reefs. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In mid-December, opposition activists from Poland's Committee for the Defense of Democracy carried European and Polish flags as they marched past the old headquarters of the Polish Communist Party, which in 1981 had declared martial law and arrested thousands of Solidarity Union activists. Today, activists warn that the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party is an autocratic regime which has restricted press freedom and undercut the Constitutional Tribunal, the nation's highest court. The protests were condemned by Law and Justice Party leader Jarosław Kaczynski as criminal and anti-state in character. Over the last year, mass protests against the socially conservative government have re-energized civil society organizing in Poland that had largely been dormant since the end of Soviet communism in 1989. Days after the march, the government outraged opponents by proposing new media restrictions in Parliament. In response, opposition lawmakers staged a sit-in in the lower house known as the Sejm. With the sit-in going on, police sealed off the grounds of the Parliament building and barred access to journalists. After 3 days of confrontation, the Law and Justice Party backed down and agreed to restore media rights in Parliament. The Polish government also withdrew a plan for a total abortion ban in October after tens of thousands of women dressed in black protested across the country. Just before Christmas, the European Commission gave Poland a 2-month deadline to retract changes to the Constitutional Court that had eroded checks and balances on executive power. Many good-paying manufacturing jobs have left the region surrounding the US Army's Fort Drum in upstate New York. Now, local leaders see new hope on the horizon with the construction and installation of ground-based missile defense interceptors. Communities in job-starved areas of Ohio, Michigan, and New York are competing for upwards of $4 billion in new Pentagon-funded construction projects. Still, many questions remain about the necessity and effectiveness of missile defense schemes to protect the U.S. from a hypothetical nuclear attack by North Korea or Iran. According to the Los Angeles Times, the missile defense system, first developed in 2004, has failed in numerous tests and could not identify fake enemy decoy warheads during drills. Currently, missile interceptors are based at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California and Fort Greely, Alaska. The Pentagon is expected to name a third site for interceptors in early 2017 and could have the backing of the new Trump administration. Big military contractors like Boeing, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman are lobbying hard for an expansion of the missile defense program. Yet critics among national security officials say expansion isn't needed and is a waste of money. Opponents in Congress, like California Congressman John Garamendi, has declared that missile defense will not work, but says momentum for the program continues to grow out of fear and the clout of military contractors. Tax expenditures through the introduction of tax credits, deductions, and exemptions really add up and distort the U.S. tax code. The popular mortgage tax deduction to promote home ownership, for example, totals $75 billion annually, and those funds are diverted away from the U.S. Treasury. The American Prospect reports that federal tax expenditures cost $300 billion more than either Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security, and about as much as all federal discretionary spending on defense, other health care programs, education, transportation systems, and much more combined. Out of fear of being labeled as big spenders, many members of Congress are more comfortable using tax expenditures to fund government programs through the tax code. That's both wasteful and promotes inequality. The infrastructure program proposed by President-elect Donald Trump would provide about $140 billion in tax credits for private infrastructure investments. Investors would shoulder only a $30 billion burden, but would receive all the profits. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says that that kind of scheme would effectively privatize those projects and would charge the public to use them. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The Obama administration's decision not to issue a veto on a December 23rd UN Security Council resolution that condemned Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank and East Jerusalem set off a firestorm in both the U.S. and Israel. The U.S. abstained, allowing the Security Council resolution to pass with 14 votes. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blasted President Obama, accusing him of a shameful ambush at the UN. Netanyahu was joined by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who also criticized the UN resolution and stated that the Palestinians would no longer have a platform at the UN when he took office. In response, outgoing Secretary of State John Kerry defended the Obama administration's UN vote in a December 28 speech, warning that Israel's continued expansion of Jewish settlements jeopardize the two-state solution that has been supported by both Democratic and Republican U.S. presidents in recent decades. Israel asserted it would ignore the UN non-binding resolution and, in defiance, announced that it planned to move ahead with the construction of nearly 6,000 new homes in Palestinian East Jerusalem. Your reporter spoke with Richard Silverstein of the progressive blog Tikkun Olam. Here he discusses the contradiction between the Obama administration's recent move at the UN and its policy towards Israel over the past 8 years, the future of the two-state solution, and what we can expect from the incoming Trump administration on Middle East policy.
To put this all in context, I think we need to go back to the beginning of the Obama first term when he went to Cairo and made a very bold, brave speech to the Arab world, talking about turning over a new leaf, a new page in relations between the U.S. And the Middle East, and how we were going to be constructive in our engagement with them, and we were going to turn away from war as an instrument of policy. And everybody was very hopeful, and those of us who are in the peace camp in terms of the Israeli-Arab conflict really thought he was going to be bold and he was going to go in new directions. And we, over the course of the years, have grown very distressed and disappointed because he gave up, essentially. He refused to expend the necessary political capital to make those things happen. He refused to pressure Israel in any very serious way, as some presidential administrations have done in the past. And he just wanted to go along to get along, basically, after a while. Then, you know, we have last week, all of a sudden, as he's leaving office or about to leave office, he decides he's going to get some gumption, and he decides, well, I'm going to let this resolution be passed without vetoing it. And the U.S. And the U.N. And Security Council over the past 8 years has really covered Israel's behind and vetoed every possible resolution that Israel viewed as a threat, including resolutions that actually agreed with our own policies. We've been vetoing right and left on Israel's behalf, and all of a sudden now we did a good thing. We did the right thing, and we let this this resolution pass. We could have, of course, done something even more courageous, and we could have voted for it, but at least we let it pass. And the Israeli response was howling in anger. Then, I think possibly in order to staunch this blood flow, Kerry announced this speech that he was going to give. The speech was pretty good in some ways, but it really overall was too little too late.
In the wake of this controversial vote at the United Nations Security Council and the admission by outgoing Secretary of State John Kerry on the likelihood of the demise of the two-state solution, is it your view that the two-state solution is dead?
Every Israeli government, whether it was a right-wing or a left-wing government, has refused to negotiate seriously. So I think, for all intents and purposes, two states can't happen, and that leaves really only one possible solution, and that is a one-state solution. What would that look like? Right now, we essentially have a one-state solution, and Israel is controlling most of the West Bank. And there are some calls in Israel by right-wingers to annex the West Bank. It's a question of what would they do with the Palestinians they annex? Would they give them full rights, which is doubtful? Would they give them no rights, which is possible? Or would they give them sort of second-class status? And if we go in that direction, we're really talking about apartheid. We're really talking about Bantustans. You know, we may be talking about Israel granting certain small enclaves of Palestinians autonomy of some kind. But really, essentially, this is a one-state solution. And we have to decide, is Israel going to be a democratic state, or is it going to be an apartheid authoritarian state?
Well, into this mess comes incoming President Donald Trump. What do we know about Donald Trump and what he'll bring to the U.S. Position on this conflict?
He's really a tabula rasa. He's never made any, until this campaign, any serious statements about the Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab conflict. But all of the signs that we have seen are really alarming, very, very alarming. This could be the most right-wing U.S. administration in terms of Israel that has ever been in the history of our country, going back to 1948. Any part of the Middle East could, if a match is dropped in the right place, could lead to an intense explosion. We really could end up having a regional conflagration. There are nuclear weapons involved. Israel has at least 200 of them, we have to remember. Really, this is one of the most frightening periods since I've been starting to write my blog.
That was Richard Silverstein of the progressive blog Tikkun Olam. Find links to his recent article examining Secretary of State John Kerry's speech and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Throughout the 2016 presidential election campaign, real estate billionaire Donald Trump showed his contempt for standard political rhetoric and instead bluntly attacked conventional bipartisan views on the need to uphold human rights, international law, and freedom of the press. Trump laid out an agenda that drew applause from his mostly white right-wing supporters, but provoked concern among civil libertarians about a Trump presidency that would be autocratic and employ repressive measures to intimidate his many opponents. Federal policies that Trump promoted included his advocacy of a ban on Muslims entering the U.S., a program mandating the registration of all Muslims in America, the mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, his endorsement of torture and murdering terrorist suspects' family members,
the expansion of mass surveillance, and opening up libel laws to more easily sue journalists and news outlets with whom he disagreed. As the president-elect has announced his administration's nominees and appointments, it's clear that many members of Trump's cabinet share his views on critical civil liberties issues. For example, Attorney General nominee Senator Jeff Sessions opposes the First Amendment rights of LGBT student groups. Michael T. Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, believes that Sharia or Islamic law is a present threat to the U.S. And Stephen Bannon, Trump's chief strategist, promoted white supremacist and Islamophobic views when he led Breitbart Media. Your reporter spoke with Chip Gibbons, policy and legislative counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who discusses the grave threat he believes the incoming Trump administration poses to civil liberties.
I mean, it's really hard to pin down Donald Trump on any sort of specific policies. He's very good at being sort of slippery and going back and forth on things. But from what he said, we know that he is going to be a nightmare for civil liberties. He's talked about surveillance of Muslims. He mentioned spying on people in mosques. He's mentioned a national Muslim registry. And it's not sure if that would be something similar to what Barack Obama just disbanded, the NSEERS registry, which was of resident immigrants in the country based on their country of origin, where all of the different countries just happen to all be majority Muslim nations, or an actual literal Muslim registry. It's difficult to figure out what he means by it, but either way, it's very frightening and something to be opposed. He also tweeted about criminalizing flag burning. He said it should be, you know, either a year in jail or loss of citizenship, which is kind of a really weird, incongruent two sets of punishments. He generally defended torture. He said some stuff about, you know, no one can tell me waterboarding doesn't work, which is interesting because one of his cabinet picks for Secretary of Defense told him waterboarding doesn't work, and he was allegedly surprised to hear that, which makes you realize that Trump doesn't usually listen to views other than his own. He said he'll do a whole lot worse than waterboarding. He said, you know, there's a debate about whether or not waterboarding is torture. Let's assume it is torture. I'm all for it. At one point, he said, you know, even if it doesn't work, the people being waterboarded deserve it. So that's a really disturbing position on torture. He also praised stop and frisk during the debate, and he called for some sort of like national stop and frisk program, which doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because it's local police, not the FBI, who are responsible for, like, you know, cursory stops on the street. But it does show that he is supportive of various policies that are tantamount to racial profiling, between his praising of stop and frisk to his really sort of unsettling comments about African-American communities, to his wanting of a Muslim registry and spying on mosques. It's clear that he's into racial and religious profiling, and the fact that he does not tolerate criticism and dissent very well, and will we have, you know, power over the NSA, over the FBI, and all these large surveillance apparatuses, is just sort of, you know, a nightmarish situation, which is what we were worrying everyone about, you know, for the last 16 years or so, you know, that if you keep building up these systems of repression, they can be abused. And of course, they have been abused by past administrations. So, you know, it wasn't like everything was rosy for civil liberties in the United States before Trump was elected. But, I mean, there has been a lot of people expressing concern about, you know, what Trump could do with the NSA that has the potential to be so terribly abused. And we also know that his cabinet picks are really unsettling, and it would seem to be that they would confirm a lot of what he said he was going to do on the campaign trail. He's picked people who are very pro-torture, who are very hostile to dissent, who have histories of racial or religious animus.
With the Trump administration coming in with an agenda that includes registering Muslims who live in the United States, a ban on Muslims entering the United States, the pledge for mass deportation of immigrants, building a wall in the southern U.S. border with Mexico, the endorsement of mass surveillance or escalating mass surveillance, reviving the official government's sanctioning of torture, challenges to press freedom. What, in your view, is some of the most effective responses for opponents of these policy agenda items?
So I think that one of the most effective means of resistance is actually organizing at the local level to pass local ordinances that limit what your local law enforcement can do. So we have two ordinances on our website and a resolution. A resolution is a non-binding statement. It's just sort of like, you know, we disagree with, you know, the climate of hatred, whereas an ordinance has the force of law. So it'll be like, our police are not allowed to cooperate with federal immigration policy or participate in mass deportations or spy on people because of their religion. And I think that it's clear that the current federal landscape is quite hostile to civil liberties. It doesn't mean we should give up or just let them do it. But for a lot of people, particularly those who live in cities that are more open about civil liberties or more supportive and not supportive of the Trump agenda, there's a real window of opportunity for passing either of these model ordinances or some version of them. And it would actually have the power of law, and it would limit what your local police could in fact do. And I know passing local resolutions or ordinances can seem like a daunting task, but other cities have done it. Like, I mean, there's a number of ways to contact us on our website about getting involved with this campaign, and we can help you get started and give you some pointers.
That was Chip Gibbons, Policy and Legislative Counsel with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Find a link to Gibbons' recent article, Meet Trump's Worst Nominees for Civil Liberties, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Coral reefs worldwide have been experiencing some of the most visible signs of climate change as coral formations struggle to adapt to warmer ocean water. A recent bleaching event devastated the northern area of the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia. Corals are an extremely important part of their ecosystems, as they are home to a great diversity of fish that provide food for other species, including humans. Due to bleaching events and other problems, scientists estimate that coral populations today are only 30 to 50% of what they were a century ago. About two-thirds of the Great Barrier Reef's northern shallow water coral, a previously pristine 430-mile stretch, is dead. Only a cyclone that reduced water temperatures by up to 3 degrees Celsius in the south saved the lower section of the 1,400-mile reef, a United Nations Natural World Heritage Site, from damage. Other global coral bleaching events have occurred in 1998, 2005, and 2010. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Steve Palumbi, professor of marine sciences at Stanford University, who serves as director of the university's marine lab in Pacific Grove, California. Professor Palumbi is an expert on the coral reefs around Palau, an island nation in the South Pacific. Here he explains that corals are both an incredibly old and resilient life form, yet very vulnerable to human activities, and provide many benefits to the ecosystem that most of us don't know.
These bleaching events have pulsed through the global coral population, in some cases reducing it by 90% locally, some cases 50%.
I have some idea of the importance of corals, but can you elaborate on that? If they collapse, what is the impact on the rest of their ecosystems?
Well, suppose somebody could come up and tell you that, say you're living in a coastal city or something like that, and they say they've just invented a self-repairing seawall, and this wall will continue to grow, it'll continue to fix itself over time, it'll continue to get wider. And by the way, it will also produce sand for your beaches. You'd look at those people and you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. That's completely impossible. There is no way that you can sell me a repairable, growable seawall that makes my beaches for me. But that's what corals do. They produce these walls in front of coastal villages, cities, towns, coastlines. They protect those coastlines from surge waves, from storms, from tsunamis. They produce the sand that beaches are made of in the tropics. And by the way, they also support almost a quarter of the marine species on the planet. They produce such an amazing volume and diversity of fish that hundreds of millions of people get most of their protein just from fishing on coral reefs.
Now, Steve Palumbi, can you clarify when bleaching kills corals and when it doesn't?
So it's happening in this animal. Corals are animals. They're a thin film of living tissue over the skeleton that they've been building. They are powered by internal symbionts that are photosynthetic. So they take the profuse sunlight on tropical reefs and convert that to energy that the coral then uses to live and grow. So when they bleach, the coral animal is alive, but the symbiont is gone. So their ability to use this sunlight as energy is gone, meaning about 90% of their food supply, their energy supply, is now unavailable to them. So it doesn't kill them outright, but it starves them. And it doesn't take very long for the coral to succumb to all the other dangers that are out there on the reefs, all the other critters eating them, boring into them, growing over them. The good news about all that is that those bleaching events, so far anyway, are transient. They happen over a week or two, the water cools back down, and the conditions are generally then okay for corals to grow. Even an intensely bleached reef can recover. And we saw that after the 1998 bleaching in Palau and in Australia and other places. A decade later, the reefs were beginning to regrow. They were coming back to a great extent. The diversity was not quite as high. But reefs, like a lot of marine ecosystems, are incredibly productive and capable of regrowing if they have the chance.
Are any countries doing better than others at protecting coral? I suppose since oceans are global, it must be handled globally.
There are aspects of it that can only be handled on a global level. You're absolutely right. Practically everything we do as humans in our economy on the coasts is detrimental to corals. Yet they have been around on the planet for a quarter of a billion years and have survived at least two mass extinctions. At one level, they seem really robust and survivors. On the other level, everything we do to them hurts them. Locally, cities, towns, villages, coastlines have a lot that they can do to support coral growth. They can prevent erosion. They can keep fertilizers and pesticides from going into the local water. They can limit overfishing.
What does your research tell you about corals' chances of survival as water temperatures keep warming?
We found that corals really are quite able to deal with high water temperatures, but just some of them are. There's some species that are very, very resistant to it, but even within species, some individual corals have the right genes, and they have the right environmental history. They're living in the right place, so that their physiology is tuned to better resist high water temperature. Then there is the two creeping problems that come along with climate change. That's the ocean getting warmer and also the ocean getting more acidified than now. Those things are not going to be changed unless we fix the global emissions problem that we have. And that requires a global solution to climate change and a global solution to throwing fossil fuels into the air.
That was Steve Palumbi, professor of marine sciences at Stanford University, director of the Hopkins Marine Station, and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment. Learn more about the urgent issue of coral bleaching by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Hepatitis gets a knockout punch. Just a few hours ago, I placed a call to my civil lawyer, Brett Grote, of the Pittsburgh-based Abolitionist Law Center. I could hear the excitement in his voice. Then he told me that we had won the Abu-Jamal versus Wetzel case, and the judge, Judge Robert Mariani, granted our motion for a preliminary injunction, ordering healthcare staff to cease their unconstitutional protocol and begin treatment of my hepatitis infection with direct-acting antiviral medications. It was good to hear and good to win. I thought of the good, hard work by Brett and attorney Bob Boyle. I thought of the many people who filled the courtroom because of the organizing prowess of Sister Pam Africa, Dr. Suzanne Ross, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, and others who made it happen. I thought of Dr. Joseph Harris, M.D., who, as an expert witness, hushed the courtroom by his medical explanations, which made scientific arguments so clear that anyone could understand it. And I thought of thousands of prisoners in Pennsylvania suffering from the ravages of hepatitis C, and now who have hope. I thought of the prisoners who suffered from hepatitis C and died from this infection as their liver failed to function. They did not live long enough to see this day. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Spread the word, because, you know, this is not what the Commonwealth wants people to know about, that they really engaged in unconstitutional medical practices designed not to cure and not even to treat, but to work on symptoms instead of disease. Here you have something that is very rare in the world of medicine. You know, doctors rarely speak of cures. They speak of treatments. Here we have a cure. And the government of Pennsylvania refused to give it to thousands of people for years until they got to the brink of death. My sister Pam told me something the other day about a Puerto Rican brother down Gratis Ford. They had him wait so long that when they approved him for treatment, he took one pill for one day, and by the next day, he was dead. So that's, you know, that to say that's unconstitutional, again, is an understatement. It's not medicine. You know, it's business, and it's profit, and it's not caring for the health of the people that you swore.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
Well, yeah, thanks for calling in, and we're here for the next step forward.
Yeah. Let it happen soon. You take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Could up to half of the peer-reviewed scientific literature be untrue? How is the billionaire Walton family working with school districts and the U.S. government to privatize education? Were there stories of indigenous resistance and struggle against oil and gas pipelines that matched or even rivaled that against the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance in North Dakota? Could increased rates of cancer in indigenous communities at the Grand Canyon be related to radioactive pollution from abandoned uranium mines? Is there a silent epidemic of military veteran suicides in Canada? Why are these and other important stories not getting more attention in the major media? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the first of 2017, we spend the show examining some of the most censored and suppressed stories of the previous year. We speak to Andy Lee Roth, an associate editor of Project Censored. We speak to John Sherto, editor and publisher of intercontinentalcry.org. And we hear from an associate professor from the University of Regina's School of Journalism, Patricia Elliott. On this week's program, Censored 2016, the most important stories that you never heard about. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 6th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Global capitalism is by no means monolithic. What is at stake are fundamental rivalries within the U.S. establishment marked by the clash between competing corporate factions, each of which is intent upon exerting control over the incoming U.S. presidency. In this regard, Trump is not entirely in the pocket of the lobby groups. As a member of the establishment, he has his own corporate sponsors and fundraisers. His stated foreign policy agenda, including his commitment to revise Washington's relationship with Moscow, does not fully conform with the interests of the defense contractors, which supported Clinton's candidacy. That comes from the article, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Campaign to Destabilize the Trump Presidency, by Professor Michel Chalsadovsky, post January 4th. The NATO war preparation against Russia, Operation Atlantic Resolve, is in full swing. 2,000 U.S. tanks will be sent in coming days from Germany to Eastern Europe, and 1,600 U.S. tanks is deployed to storage facilities in the Netherlands. At the same time, NATO countries are sending thousands of soldiers in to Russian borders. According to U.S. Army Europe, 4,000 troops and 2,000 tanks will arrive in three U.S. transport ships to Germany next weekend. From Bremerhaven, U.S. troops and huge amount of military material will be transported to Poland and other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. That was from a reposting of an article by Donbass International News Agency under the headline, Political Insanity, Outgoing President Obama's Operation Atlantic Resolve Against Russia. U.S. sends 3,600 tanks against Russia. Massive NATO deployment underway. With an introductory note by Michel Chalsadovsky, post January 4th. The move towards a cashless society would secure a further degree of control over India by the institutions who are pushing for it. Securing payments that accrue from each digital transaction would, of course, be very financially lucrative for them. These institutions are therefore pursuing a global war on cash. Small wealthy countries like Denmark and Sweden can bear the impact of a transition to a cashless economy, but for a country such as India, which runs on cash, the outcomes so far have been catastrophic for hundreds of millions of people, especially those who don't have a bank account, almost half the population, or do not even have easy access to a bank. But regardless of the large-scale human suffering imposed as a result of demonetization, it could kill two birds with one stone. One, securing the interests of international capital, including the eventual displacement of the informal, i.e. self-organized economy, and two, acting as another deliberate nail in the coffin of Indian farmers, driving even more of them out of the sector. That comes from the article, India, From the Destabilization of Agriculture to Demonetization, Made in America, by Colin Todd Hunter, post January 5th. The Fukushima nuclear power plant accident in Japan 6 years ago has not been fixed. It is becoming increasingly evident that it is difficult to fix it. As three reactors' nuclear fuel rods were melted, there is no precedence for such a disaster in human history. The health effects of radioactive material released are becoming significant day by day. Unfortunately, its reality has been covered up by the Japanese government. What's more, the government is eagerly trying to restart the nuclear power plants, as many as possible, having done so three nuclear power reactors so far, despite the fact that no electricity shortage has been experienced when no single nuclear power plant was in operation for 2 years, 2013 to 2015. That comes from the article, Fukushima Radiation Looms, No Nuclear Power Plant on Planet Earth, The Incompatibility of Radiation with Human Life, by Aikiro Okiai, posted January 5th. Let me summarize the British government's contribution to the genocide in Rwanda. Britain used its diplomatic weight to severely reduce a UN force that, according to military officers on the ground, could have prevented the killings. It then helped ensure the delay of other plans for intervention, which sent a direct green light to the murderers in Rwanda to continue. Britain also refused to provide the capability for other states to intervene while blaming the lack of such capability on the UN. Throughout, Britain helped ensure that the UN did not use the word genocide, so the UN would not act, using diplomatic pressure on others to ensure this did not happen. That comes from the article, Britain's Role in Rwanda's 1994 Genocide, by Mark Curtis, post January 5th, originally appearing at markcurtis.info. Nobody would believe, either in the UN General Assembly or any other public forum, that United Fruit supported or opposed governments based on democratic convictions. On the other hand, no one would dare challenge the actions of the U.S. government abroad to assist a government it declared to be democratic. Moreover, if United Fruit broke the law, the local government could punish it even by expropriation, but no local government would dare take such action against the United States itself. That could mean even war. Hence, the CIA was invented in the National Security Act, not simply as an advisory and coordinating instrument for spying, but as a criminal organization to cover for the fundamental criminal activity of U.S. corporations and those who own them. That comes from the article, The History of the CIA, Review of Douglas Valentine's Book, by Dr. P. Wilkinson, posted January 5th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. 2016 has been a notable year for news, with the Standing Rock protests, the election of Donald Trump, and the deaths of a plethora of celebrities. As has become an annual tradition on the Global Research News Hour, we're bringing a review of the important stories that did not make national or international headlines. We're joined now by Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored. He's here to tell us about the organization's top 25 most censored stories of the year. So, Andy, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
Can you just very briefly explain to us Project Censored and what it's all about?
Yeah, Project Censored, our primary mission is to expose and oppose news censorship in all its guises. So, you know, the latest spate of fake news comes to mind. And we also do quite a bit with media literacy education, especially for college students, college and university students, who many of the stories we'll end up talking about today are stories that have been researched by students at colleges and universities across the country and indeed up in Canada as well, who are working in Project Censored affiliated courses with professors at those campuses.
Okay, great. And you're based in Sonoma County in California.
Our home base is originally at Sonoma State University, but since we started this what we call our campus affiliates program, we're in many ways a much more kind of horizontal and decentralized organization than we were at our outset 40 years ago.
Okay, well, well done. Okay, there are a couple of stories, certain themes running through some of your top 25. There's a couple with a sort of an educational theme, you might say, one on the Department of Education collusion with something called ALEC to privatize the educational system in the United States. Also another one having to do with, let's see, Walmarting of the educational system. You can give us a bit of a breakdown of those stories.
Yeah, and so I should say just before we dive into any one of the stories, part of what we do at Project Censored every year is we monitor news stories that are being covered in the independent press that are either not being covered at all in the corporate media or are being covered in a way that is partial in one or both senses of that term, partial incomplete or partial in a biased or slanted sort of way. And so these two, our number 20 story, the Walmarting of American education, and number 22 on the Department of Education cooperating with ALEC to privatize education, both fit those criteria. They've been well covered in the independent press and not so well covered or covered in distorted ways. So on the Department of Education story, ALEC is, of course, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a lobbying organization. The main gist of this story, which was originally reported in PR Watch in January of this year by Dustin Bielke, is that a slide deck PowerPoint-type presentation made at the Department of Education revealed the extent to which the federal government has been supporting boosting charter schools. And Bielke reports on this December 2015 slide presentation that shows over $3 billion in taxpayer money to boost charter schools and describes the 25-slide overview of the Department of Education's charter school programs as an uncritical PR document that embraces a magical idea of charter schools.
Yeah, and of course, so as we're seeing like this all whole, the educational system increasingly becoming more and more privatized. The Walmart story with the Walton family involved in that is also a very concerning development, it would seem, one that you're not hearing much about, that goes along with the closing of a whole bunch of Walmart stores, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right, Michael. And this goes back, if you trace it back, it's the kind of alignment of a philosophical sense of the world between the Walton Family Foundation and the economic philosophy of the libertarian Milton Friedman, who was part of the kind of agenda under the Reagan administration to challenge this, quote, rising tide of mediocrity, and they started what many of us today think of as a myth of public school failures. And so the Walton Family Foundation announced a plan in January of this year, right around the time, as you mentioned, that they were announcing closure of some 269 of their retail stores, announced that they would be spending billions of dollars over the next 5 years to support and expand charter schools in 13 U.S. cities and states. They were, as Education Week reported, they were doubling down on their investments in what's known euphemistically as school choice, but is really, again, part of this larger privatization agenda.
Mm. Now, you also have a couple of stories that discuss the prison system.
Yes. Yeah. One of those is our number 17 story this year on deadly medical neglect for immigrants who are held in these privatized U.S. jails. This story was originally reported by Seth Fried Wessler in The Nation earlier this year. He spent more than 2 years attempting to obtain the medical records of more than 100 inmates, all of whom were immigrants, who died in custody in these privately run prison companies. These are the companies that may be familiar to some of the audience, the Corrections Corporation of America, GEO Group, and a little less well-known, the Management and Training Corporation. And they run these private prisons. In this case, the ones that Seth Fried Wessler ultimately undertook a federal lawsuit in order to obtain the medical records of these 103 prisoners. The standards in these prisons are different because they are contracted privately. And so what Wessler found when he began looking at the documents, the medical records, were that many of these men died unnecessarily. They suffered from critical delay in care for things like mental illness, heart disease, liver conditions. They often were not diagnosed correctly for what were obvious and painful but treatable symptoms. And in many of the cases, in nearly 20% of the cases, licensed vocational nurses were undertaking the kind of treatments that would normally be appropriately the work of medical doctors, and these were clearly cost-cutting measures that were possible only in a privatized setting. Mm-hmm. There are two updates that I would add since the Censored 2017 went to press. There's some good news on this story. In August of this year, the Deputy Attorney General directed the Bureau of Prisons to reduce and ultimately to eliminate their use of privately operated prisons. In her memo, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates said that private prison facilities do not provide the same services or resources, they do not save money, and they don't maintain the same level of safety and security. There was no mention of Seth Fried Wessler's report in The Nation, I'd like to believe that the publicity given by his report was part of the decision there. When that report was made, when the Deputy Attorney General made that announcement, the stocks, the CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, stocks plummeted 35%. The GEO Group stocks went down 40%. The update on this would be that on the day after Donald Trump appeared to have won the Electoral College, he, of course, has been an advocate of privatized prisons. Those stock shares skyrocketed. CCA went up 43%. GEO Group went up 21% on the news of Trump's victory. And for people following that story, an important development that I came across last month, the Corrections Corporation of America, which certainly should be followed and should be on our radar, has rebranded itself as an organization now known as CORE Civic, which is the two words CORE and Civic all is one word. And these companies, I think that the upshot of this story is that these companies, to quote one of the American Civil Liberties Union's people who follows the prison issues, Carl Takai, he says these companies, by their nature, depend on and profit from mass incarceration.
Mm. Yeah, and I know that the medical system seems to be kind of highlighted in this series. I I mean, there's a story here, not only the one you just mentioned, but also the U.S. vaccine court paying out over $3 billion to vaccine-injured families. Number nine, Big Pharma lobbies outside of presidential election campaigns, about seven times more than during a presidential election. And this one that really came as a shocker to me, crisis in evidence-based medicine. Derived from an article that was actually in The Lancet. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, that's our number two story this year. And the Lancet article is from April of 2015, when the editor of that very prestigious medical journal, Richard Horton, wrote, "Something has gone fundamentally wrong with one of our greatest human creations." And he continues, "Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue." And what he's pointing to are studies conducted with small sample sizes, studies that find effects, but the effects are tiny, exploratory analyses that don't have complete validity, and, of course, what's probably the most important of these is the flagrant conflicts of interest that often drive medicine. Now, there are two points to, I think, add to the piece that Horton published in The Lancet, that is the core story for this crisis in evidence-based medicine. First of all, he's not the first prominent editor or editor. He's not the first editor of a prominent medical journal to raise these concerns. Back in 2009, Marcia Angell, who had been the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, had raised very similar concerns. But to me, in some ways, the most interesting aspect of this story there has been some coverage of you know, the corporate media will from time to time cover stories on clinical trials and how clinical trials are affected by external interests. The Washington Post, for instance, has run some stories on this very scandalous study of the drug paroxetine. But what's interesting is in what little corporate coverage there is, the corporate coverage never mentions one of the solutions that are being put into effect, right? So if we have a crisis in evidence-based medicine, is there anything that can be done about it? And one of the the independent news stories that we cover as in the censored book on this topic are following what's known as a new open trials initiative, and a very specific one that's known as the Restoring Invisible and Abandoned Trials, which has been promoted by the BMJ, which many people will know as the British Medical Journal. And the idea is that any kind of clinical trials data under or any kind of clinical trials undertaken by pharmaceutical companies would have to make all of the data from those trials available for independent scientific scrutiny. And various of these campaigns now have the backing of literally hundreds of medical and research organizations. So this is one of those cases that I always find very interesting at Project Censored when we look at these underreported stories, where it's not simply that the story is underreported, but the bad news part of the story, there actually is a good news counterpart, or at least a solutions perspective. But that solutions perspective is in the case of this story has been omitted by the corporate media coverage, but is very prominent when you look at the independent journalists, the work of the independent journalists who have been covering the story. Mm. And so that fits very much a notion of the corporate news as serving specific agendas and not necessarily serving the task of informing the public in a way that would allow us to be engaged citizens and community members.
Okay, well, we've got plenty of other stories here. I mean, NYPD editing stories on police brutality in the Wikipedia, the modern-day slavery, sex trafficking of underage girls, the global epidemic of electronic waste, Internet Surveillance Act nobody's discussing,
And you know, there's 1.5 million U.S. families living on less than $2 a day. So these, I mean, we don't have time to go into all of these in depth, but I do certainly encourage people to check out the website projectcensored.org. But it's also, as you mentioned, there's also a book on that's available. And this, the top 25 is really only the first chapter in a 10-chapter book. So you want to maybe give us a bit of a breakdown of some of the other features in that book.
Yeah, just very quickly, I'll point to a few highlights. And of course, I you know, with more time, we'd talk some about each of the chapters because each is a kind of a gem in its own right. This year is Project Censored's 40th anniversary. One of our regular features in the book is what we call Deja Vu News, where we go back and look at well, what happened to stories that were in the top 25 lists from previous years? And this year, since it was our 40th anniversary, we asked our panel of esteemed judges who help us to identify and rank each year's top 25 to help us identify five or six stories from the entire history of Project Censored that they would like to see updates on. And so Susan Rahman, who teaches sociology at College of Marin, in Northern California. Susan Rahman and her students did our Deja Vu News 40th anniversary edition Deja Vu News chapter this year, strolling down memory hole lane. And we've gone back all the way to 1977 when the number one story was The Myth of Black Progress. That's updated now. Our number one story in 1987, The Information Monopoly, a story written by Ben Bagdikian. We've brought up to date. And then we've gone back, for instance, to No Habeas Corpus for Any Person, the number one story in 2008. So Deja Vu is a look backwards and bringing those stories up to the present. Every year we have a fantastic story. I think in many ways it's the best place to enter the Project Censored book each year. We look at Carl Jensen, our founder, called Junk Food News. And so we have an updated chapter on junk food news and news abuse, a term that Peter Phillips, the past director of Project Censored, coined to capture another way that news can work as propaganda. And this year's chapter on junk food and news abuse, which is done by Nolan Higdon and students of his, is all focused on the news coverage of the presidential primaries. And there's just some amazing stuff here, including among the junk food stories, Les Moonves, the chairman of the board, the president and the CEO of CBS, one of our major networks, of course, saying that he's never seen anything like this on the Trump, the attention to Trump in the primaries. And he says, and this is going to be a very good year for us, meaning CBS. Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, Les Moonves said, but bring it on, Donald. Keep on going. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole chapter of analysis with those kind of nuggets.
Okay.
Later in the book, we talk some. We have a chapter from Susan Merritt on conspiracy theories and thinking about how conspiracy theories operate in a period where there's increasing government surveillance and government secrecy. We have an amazing chapter by Brian Covert, who many people who read the book each year will know. Brian always does tremendous work for us. Brian has written a very accessible chapter that looks at basically the history of the CIA, the press, and how those relationships have resulted in distortions to our news. And I could go on. There are many other good chapters here.
Yeah, it sounds quite fascinating. And certainly I would encourage our listeners to pick up a copy. It's Censored 2017, and it's featuring all the most underreported and censored stories or suppressed stories of the past year. Andy Lee Roth, thank you once again for joining us. I really appreciate this contribution.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to join you.
We've been speaking with Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
If you focus solely on mainstream or even a lot of alternative media, you'd think that the standoff at Standing Rock is the only story of import in terms of indigenous resistance. However, as my next guest can confirm, there are plenty of stories of indigenous struggle around the world getting systemically ignored by the press. Intercontinental Cry has a mandate to document these stories and report them to a wider global audience. John Shurto is the lead editor of Intercontinental Cry. He joins us from Winnipeg. Hello, John. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I think that there's a, in terms of some of the big stories that that weren't quite fit to print in the major media, there's a, another story here. One of the stories you've got is about 16 pipelines that are moving forward in the U.S. that impact indigenous lands.
Yeah, there's at least 16, including the Dakota Access Pipeline, that affect indigenous lands throughout U.S. and also, you know, pipelines that originate in the U.S., that also affect indigenous lands in Canada and in Mexico. We're talking about, you know, 16 major movements, even though none of them have really become movements except for, you know, those against the Keystone and the Dakota Access Pipeline. But, you know, there is one movement now that's slowly being developed, and that's concerning the Agua Prieta pipeline, which runs from Arizona to Sonora, Mexico, through Yaqui territories in Mexico. The Yaqui have actually been resisting that since October, and there was a violent altercation in October that resulted in the death of one Yaqui person and the injury of eight others when, you know, supporters of the pipeline attacked the protest camp. But so, like, this was taking place, you know, nearing the height of the movement against the Dakota Access, and, you know, there was no mention of it anywhere. I didn't even hear about it, and I'm, like, tapped into, you know, everything. So it's pretty alarming that we haven't heard anything. I'm trying to get some people down there to start covering this. But, you know, there's several other pipelines, too, that have also started coming forward, especially in light of no DAPL, such as the Trans-Pecos pipeline in Texas and the Sabal Trail pipeline, which runs from Alabama to Georgia down to southern central Florida, also affecting indigenous lands. You know, and there's basically no coverage anywhere about any of them.
Mm. Now, I noticed there's another story that you have listed. It's about the Wixárika people, in the indigenous peoples who are being threatened by land grabs from Mexican ranchers. What are the dynamics of that story?
Well, it's fairly complicated, actually. Like, the Mexican government started appropriating the Wixárika lands in the early 1900s. They appropriated about 10,000 hectares. And, you know, the Wixárika, or who are also known as the Huichole, you know, I guess they let it slide, basically. But they've been moving in more recent times to reclaim the land. And, you know, they took the legal approach, and they've, you know, exercised their legal right to the territory in, like, nine different land claims or something like that, most of which are still, like, stalled out in court. But they're, you know, just tired of jumping through these legal hoops. So, you know, they started in September to take back the land directly by occupying it. So in September, like, a contingent of at least 1,000 Wixárika mobilized to reclaim the land. And the situation is actually extremely volatile due to the nature of the, or at least the sentiment of the current landholders. You know, non-indigenous ranchers and other, you know, business-oriented folks who tend to look down on the Wixárika as, you know, less than human, which is a sentiment that we see throughout the world. But, you know, like, there was one of the largest landholders in the region when the Wixárika mobilized, publicly called the Wixárika a plague, for an example. And there was one headline in the region that screamed that the blood is going to run if these, you know, insects get their way. There was also individuals in the region cited wearing military clothing and carrying weapons that are exclusively used by the armies, AK-47s and R-15s. But they disappeared, and somehow, fortunately, thankfully, cooler minds have prevailed so far. There haven't been any violent altercations. And instead of letting the situation become a racism-fueled ground war, both the ranchers and the Wishirika have asked for the governments to act as a third-party mediator to resolve the situation. And that's kind of where the situation stands at the moment. Everybody's waiting for the government to step in and resolve this.
Oh, my.
We just had one of our editors, Tracy Barnett, was just there like 2 weeks ago. And she's probably going to go back for updates because, yeah, like this situation could turn ugly very quickly.
Mm.
So we're keeping eyes on it.
Now, here's another story basically relating to the uranium mining in the Grand Canyon and its impacts on the Havasupe and Diné peoples.
Yep.
Uranium mining, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, about 75% of the uranium in the United States is on treaty or federal land. And so there's bound to be disproportionate impacts on indigenous peoples. So what's happening here in the Grand in that territory?
Most people, think that there isn't any uranium mining within the Grand Canyon area where uranium mining has, historically taken place. There's, tens of thousands of abandoned uranium mines already there. But earlier this decade or last decade, the U.S. government opened up the lands for prospecting, which resulted in 30,000 new uranium mining claims. That in turn resulted in the moratorium. And because of that moratorium, people think that there isn't any uranium mining ongoing in the region, but that's not true. There's at least three mines, uranium mines, owned by Energy Fuels Resources Incorporated. One of those mines, which is located on the traditional territory of the Havasupai people, and which this particular mine called the Canyon Mine is near a place called Red Butte, which is a mountain that's held sacred by the Havasupai. The Havasupai believe that all life began in this region. There's also a watershed in the region that could be affected, but the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has been, very accommodating of EFRI. They've, given them everything that the company wants. And, most recently, the company applied for air permits so that they could transport uranium from the Canyon Mine, which they're actively drilling, to their processing mill in Utah. The ADEQ, gave them all the permits. So next year, I'm not sure of the exact day, but the company is going to be transporting, the uranium ore 300 miles from the Canyon Mine to the processing mill on flatbed trucks or, on like dump truck type things, 30-ton trucks, I think. And the uranium ore is only going to be secured in place by tarps that are, quote-unquote, securely tied down with rope. Anybody who understands uranium knows that if the rock can let off dust, which will go directly into the air and can potentially contaminate anything along the way, but apparently that's acceptable. So there's a movement slowly building that is going to be trying to stop this project. And if anybody wants to learn more about that, they can go to halno.org. HALNO.org you can get updates on the situation there.
Yeah, I'd certainly encourage that. That's certainly a story that deserves further exploration and updates.
Absolutely.
Colombia, there's a peace accord put together between the FARC and the government, and it was rejected in a popular referendum by a slim, narrow margin, but it's the indigenous peoples are apparently looking to implement it anyway. This is a story by Hannah Wallace from October.
Yeah. Like the situation is, obviously very precarious for the indigenous peoples in the region because, as a result of this 52-year conflict between FARC and the Colombian government, at least 64 of the 102 indigenous nationalities in Colombia are now facing extinction. So, you know, they've been, you know, desperately trying to bring an end to the conflict on their territory, obviously, for decades. But they've been, you know, caught between three parties and all, not just FARC and, you know, other leftist-oriented groups, but also the Colombian governments and, you know, paramilitary groups, right-wing groups. So, you know, the peace accord all obviously would have brought an end to at least the conflict between FARC and the government, and so there was no really resolution with regard to the paramilitary groups. But you know, aside from that, you know, the indigenous peoples are just, you know, sick and tired of you know, having their families kidnapped and murdered and forced into labor by this or that group or whatever, and being pinned against each other and infiltrated, and you know, having their territories filled with landmines, and then being forced to serve as you know, canaries, so to speak, who walk in front of the armed groups in case they run into landmines and so forth. Mm. So, you know, they're trying to implement you know, aspects of the peace deal that will benefit them and that are appropriate for their territories. And we actually have somebody in Colombia now who's monitoring this process. And, you know, he reported last week, we just published a story about it, that paramilitary violence is actually on the rise in Colombia this particular year. So, like, when the peace accord was, you know, just on the table, paramilitary violence started rising. And, you know, in the past, paramilitary groups like the Black Eagles, you know, primarily worked in any way that would serve state interests. And they're basically still doing that. But now that Colombia and FARC are kind of, you know, sitting nicely together, they're becoming like more independent, like private security services that are still like as vicious as ever. But, you know, they're still acting, you know, but they're more acting independently, but still in the service of the state. So, like, it's very difficult to know how this situation is going to be resolved without the Colombian government stepping in and, you know, demobilizing all these organizations if they can. You know, either way, I think the indigenous peoples are going to continue to move forward so that they can, you know, finally, after so many decades, live safely within their own territories.
I think we've only got time for one more story, and this is one having to do, it's called Photos Behind the Miskutu Curtain, and this refers to indigenous peoples in Nicaragua, and it seems kind of interesting because there the villain would appear to be the Sandinista government, which you know, people on the left typically tend to put on a bit of a pedestal. So
yeah, they're not necessarily the villain. The enablers. Yes, that would be much more accurate. The so-called villain, or at least the antagonist would be the better word, are the settlers known as colonos, who are actively and violently and illegally seizing Miskito territories using fake land claims. And who knows, like nobody knows where these land claims are coming from. But, you know, the President Daniel Ortega has at least admitted publicly that they're illegal, but he, as far as taking action to stop them, they haven't. He hasn't done anything yet. So IC visited the Miskito's traditional territory earlier this year, you know, the word on the street was that the Miskito were organizing themselves into an armed militia in the event that the Ortega government failed to, you know, respond to their calls for justice and peace, because like these colonels are you know, flooding homes with machine gun fire. I mean, like there's a lot of people are being killed, and you know, there was also some discussion about you know, instead of taking a more aggressive approach, that they would simply organize a self-defense force similar to what the Purépecha town of Chirán did in Mexico, by, you know, arming itself to banish a Mexican cartel from their land and lives. it's not like there, nothing has really come about at this point. You know, the mosquito are still, you know, hoping and begging for the government to just get off its butt and, you know, do what it needs to do. Unfortunately, you know, as with so many of these other stories, the media is virtually silent. I guess it's to be expected, but it's very alarming that the alternative media has been particularly silent. You know, and that is largely because we're talking about, you know, something that is being enabled by a very popular and very beloved, you know, leftist government. And, you know, there's even been some media publications attacking IC and anyone else who sides with the mosquito, because it, you know, threatens to tarnish the image of the Sandinistas. And it's very unfortunate, but, you know, I guess that's just, you know, one of the many difficulties that indigenous peoples face.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so John, thank you for joining us. Is there anything you'd like to say with regard to Intercontinental Cry? I know it's 100% financed by the readers. So, I mean, is there an ongoing fundraiser or any other upcoming events that people should be aware of?
There is an ongoing fundraiser. We are basically out of funds. We have enough money to run IC for another maybe 8 weeks, if we're lucky. So, like, if anybody sees value in these stories or really supports Indigenous frontline struggles, I encourage them to come over to intercontinentalcry.org and pitch in.
Okay. John Chertow, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Chertow is the lead editor of Intercontinental Cry, a permanent volunteer-driven platform that raises the voices of the world's 5,000 Indigenous peoples. He joined us from Winnipeg. Before we close the show, this being a Canadian broadcast, I thought it would be instructive to touch briefly on Canadian stories that somehow didn't receive major coverage. Joining us by phone from the University of Regina is Patricia Elliott. She is associate professor with the University School of Journalism and was also a faculty advisor with Project Censored. Mm-hmm. Greetings, Professor Elliott, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much for inviting me.
Okay, so, I mean, there are a number of stories that here in Canada didn't get a lot of attention. Maybe we'll start off with a story that's kind of gotten resurrected in light of a recent tragedy in Halifax, mm-hmm. that murder, a military murder-suicide. There are a couple of stories here relating to Canadian veterans, one having to do with the alarming suicide rate, and another about Canadian soldiers returning to life in the streets. You want to maybe just elaborate a little bit on the significance of those stories?
Sure. So what we asked the students to do is to kind of look outside the box to find stories that were under the radar last year. And Tanessa Wild, one of our students, she looked at two stories dealing with vets, one on the rate of suicide and one also on the rate of homelessness. And certainly these are issues that are no doubt related. There has been mainstream coverage when there's been a tragedy of some type, as we're seeing now. So it's not like it's been entirely ignored, but certainly we've seen a bit more attention. In this case, it was the news outlet Rabble, online source of independent news, that has spent some time really looking into the situation of our veterans in Canada. I think our American counterparts were quite surprised when they read these stories, when we submitted them to Project Censored, because although this is a major issue in the U.S., I don't think they saw it as there being any sort of equivalent in Canada, but we certainly do have these problems here too.
Amazing. So we're talking about some, I think over the course of 2 years, I can, something like 54 suicides?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is, as it was headlined, an alarming rate. It's something that, again, we see this being talked about within that world, among the people involved, but no sense that it's being systematically tracked and kept in the public eye.
Hmm.
So what Tanessa found was there had been some stuff in the Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail is actually does a pretty good job on a lot of overlooked stories. but certainly nothing of in-depth really looking at why this is happening here in Canada as well.
Mm. Now, another story I'd like to bring up, and I guess this resonates in the sense that there's been a lot of talk about missing and murdered women in Canada. And I noticed the story about unsolved cases of murdered women in Halifax, and in which you build on the case of the conviction of one Glenn Assoon, who is a wrongful conviction. You know, do you want to maybe elaborate a little bit on this this rash of murders in Halifax? And
yeah, this is a story that was uncovered by Joelle Seal when she was looking for stories absent from the mainstream. It is the reporter who's been covering this is a owner-operator of an online alternative news source called the Halifax Examiner. Very good independent investigative reporting coming out of the Examiner. And it's a winner of a Canadian Association of Journalism Award for investigation on some of their work. So what happened was the reporter in this case was looking into a wrongful conviction, and in the course of this discovered a whole raft of unsolved murders in Nova Scotia, and sort of brought that to light. It's not something we had heard about. I had never heard about this until I read the report on it that came from the Examiner. And it's a very good example of women who simply go missing. Their families are concerned, but nobody's putting the pieces together and really looking at, is this a case where the wrong person was jailed and an actual killer was still on the loose?
Sounds a little, because I noticed these are murders, these murdered women were on the margins of society. Mm-hmm. It seems somewhat like resonates with the Picton murders on the West Coast, no?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and again, that the Picton murders, again, that was an example where it was well known about, well talked about among the affected communities, but no traction outside those communities. And that's been the whole story around missing and murdered Indigenous women as well. If you were involved in any way in reading feminist news outlets or Indigenous news media, this was a story that's been around for decades, but never broke through to the mainstream until recent years.
Hmm. So it seems like the stories aren't being, or lessons aren't quite being learned or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, this will happen, and that's why I tell the students, don't discount sources that are non-mainstream, because that's where you'll often find the stories that are bubbling that people are talking about, but aren't getting the attention they need.
Here's another story that I'd really like you to discuss. Ontarians can't afford dental care.
Yeah.
2.3 million people in Ontario can't afford to visit a dentist or dental hygienist.
Yeah, and that should be a major health story because we know so many other health outcomes are connected to dental care. That's a story that my student Allison Bamford looked into. We can relate it to in Saskatchewan. We had our northern dental care internship program was closed. So there's another story that did not receive much attention, but maybe should, to look at what is going to be the impact on this on northern communities that really relied on a dental care program.
Yeah, here's another one I want to get into. Migrant workers and the campaign for permanent residency to protect their rights. And I know that there's a large underbelly. Part of what makes our economy works, unfortunately, is a lot of exploitation of these foreign workers who don't, you know, they don't have the same benefits as the rest of the population. And so there's a story here, this harvesting freedom issue. You want to just maybe give us the skinny on that one there?
Okay, now that was a story. It was about a group that launched a petition campaign to begin lobbying for the rights of migrant workers. These are some of the toughest stories. If you've ever been involved in social movements, launching a campaign and it just hits dead silence in the media, this is kind of what happened. I mean, it's not like migrant workers have never been covered in the media, but for groups that are really trying to make a change, it tends to be those stories don't really get picked up that often. you know, it's not, you know, these are the kind of good news stories where people are trying to make a difference, but they are seen as either too radical, too fringe, or not exciting enough for the readership in the mainstream media, so they simply get ignored.
Yeah, and then that's sort of like with the murdered women in Halifax story all over again. Just basically people, depending on who's affected, they don't quite matter. Or are not fit to print.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's as clear-cut as that. Newsrooms across the country are also under a great deal of stress. They don't have a lot of available staff to cover anything.
Well, here's one more. I think we'll just we should just touch on, and this is, I guess, technically this happened in 2015, but the question of Israeli Defense Forces suspected of shooting a Canadian Palestinian artist.
That's quite a shocking story, and not just kind of random fire in the course of an uprising, but actual sniper shot that. The artist Rahab Nazal was injured in the leg by a bullet that appears to be an IDF, the type of bullet that they use. I didn't hear, I think the local press in London reported on it. And again, Rabble has been great in covering a lot of these stories. So I know Michael Joel Hansen, or no, it was Brandon Harder, the student who looked into that one, found some stuff on Rabble about it. But to me as a Canadian, that would be quite shocking to know that one of our nationals was a target over there.
Yeah. Well, I guess I just in the time that remains, I was wondering if you could just give us maybe your take on what insights you have into the forces specific to Canada that might be conspiring to keep certain important and impactful stories off the media radar screen.
Well, I think specific to Canada, we just have a very our media ecology here is just unhealthy. We have a very low level of competition among the mainstream media, very few incentives for them to dig harder. There was an opportunity, like we have huge media concentration here, and study after study has shown this is where it leads, to a very complacent media. There was an opportunity when the National Post chain bought out Sun Media. It went before the Competition Bureau. Even though this was a debt-ridden company that had promised to keep the Sun papers open in each market as separate newsrooms, as soon as that was approved, they began closing and consolidating newsrooms. So you've got complacent mainstream media, and then alternative media, which does a relatively good job. In Canada, that means to keep that media operating, we have a system of government grants. Those grants were pretty much decimated down to nothing under the Harper government. So our alternative media is also struggling a great deal to cover these stories.
And it sounds like that it's a worsening trend.
Yes, definitely in terms of mainstream media. Basically, it's not just the marketplace that has failed, but also our government that has failed to protect us from excessive concentration and to hold these media companies to account for delivering the news, which is what we really need. I don't think there's a loss of appetite for investigative reporting out there. And I don't think there's a lot of great journalists who want to do that kind of reporting. So it's finding new ways to do it, whether that's through cooperatives or through arm's length foundations that can support investigative journalism. But definitely we're lacking it right now.
Well, it's been good to talk to you, Patricia Elliott. Thank you very much for those perspectives.
Great talking to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. We've been speaking with Patricia Elliott, associate professor with the University of Regina's School of Journalism and a faculty evaluator with Project Censored. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm.
You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.